Good morning. I am Al Wall, the Administrative Law Judge, pursuant to temporary appointment designated by the Office of Administrative Hearings upon the request of the North Dakota Public Service Commission to serve as the hearing officer for this consolidated hearing. This is the consolidated hearing of the applications of Montana-Dakota Utilities Co. and Otter Tail Power Company for an advanced determination of prudence for their respective investments in air quality control equipment at the Big Stone Generating Plant. Those applications are North Dakota Public Service Commission cases number PU-11-163 and PU-11-165, respectively. Before proceeding with the consolidated hearing, I will ask commissioners for their comments and any directions for the hearing. Commission President Tony Clark.
Just good morning and welcome. I look forward to a good hearing over the next day or so. We have a couple of days set aside for this, although I'd remind folks that's an end limit and not a goal, necessarily. Thank you.
Commissioner Kevin Kramer.
Well, just good morning. Welcome. Thanks for all the hard work. I would just admonish the advocates to read the first five verses of Deuteronomy 20 this morning, and it'll speak for itself.
Commissioner Brian Koch.
Just good morning, and thank you for all your work, and I just want to know who's minding the store back at Otter Tail and MDU. So, anyway, I look forward to a thorough hearing.
Thank you, commissioners. For the record, it is a little after 8:30 o'clock a.m., November 29, 2011, at the hearing room of the North Dakota Public Service Commission Capitol Building, Bismarck. The time, date, and place duly noticed pursuant to and in accordance with statute and rule for the consolidated hearing of the applications of Montana-Dakota Utilities Co. and Otter Tail Power Company for an advanced determination of prudence for their respective investments in air quality control equipment at the Big Stone Generating Plant. North Dakota Public Service Commission cases number PU-11-163 and PU-11-165, respectively. The notice of consolidated hearing for this hearing issued by the Commission dated September 7, 2011, specified the issue to be considered and determined in each case upon this consolidated hearing as whether the resource addition is prudent. Counsel, please state your appearance for the record. Mr. Brown.
Your Honor, good morning. For the applicants, Andy Brown from the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, and with me is my colleague Pam Marentette.
Mr. Kuntz.
Dan Kuntz, 1200 West Century Avenue, appearing on behalf of the applicant, Montana-Dakota Utilities Co.
Mr. Bring.
Mark Bring on behalf of Otter Tail Power Company.
Mr. Grumman.
Mark Grumman, advocacy staff. Richard Hahn, also on behalf of advocacy staff, and Chris Merle.
And Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco, advisory staff.
If there is anyone present other than those persons who will testify on behalf of Montana Dakota Utilities or Otter Tail Power Company, who would address the commission regarding either or both of these cases, I ask please that you talk to me during the recess of the hearing to arrange to do that. The same would apply for anyone who happens to be listening via the internet stream. If you have interest in either of these cases and think that you would wish to address the commission concerning these cases, again, please arrange to talk to me sometime during a recess to arrange to do that. I expect to take approximately a 10-minute recess, roughly every 90 minutes or so in the course of the hearing. We'll recess for lunch, of course. And about 5 o'clock, we'll recess for the day. I'll be available at all of those times to talk with anyone who wishes to address the commission, and I'll be glad to assist you however I can to do that. Mr. Brown, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, commissioners. The applicants are here to seek an advanced determination of prudence for the installation of an air quality control system at the Big Stone plant in South Dakota. The air quality control system is necessary to comply with the South Dakota Regional Haze Rule, which requires that best available retrofit technology be applied at this particular plant. If this air quality control system is not installed at the plant, then the Big Stone plant would not be able to continue to operate. We believe that we are able to present a case to you today that will show that it is reasonable and prudent to proceed with the air quality control system. Under the South Dakota Regional Haze Rule, the deadline for complying with that requirement is two-part. It provides that it must be done as expeditiously as possible and no later than 5 years after EPA's final review and action on the South Dakota SIP as it pertains to the BART requirement. The cost of the project is estimated to be $489 million in 2015 dollars. The companies have worked to come up with a proposal to ensure the lowest reasonable cost. That really has two parts, and we'll cover this in the testimony of Mark Rolfs and some of the other witnesses that you'll hear from later. By getting to the market sooner, getting there before so many other plants in the country have to comply with this type of requirement and other Clean Air Act requirements, and also by pursuing it through a hybrid contract strategy where Otter Tail, as the operating agent for the three co-owners of the Big Stone plant, would solicit bids for major parts of the work and then use a single erection contractor in order to proceed with the work. And again, Mark Rolfs is one of our witnesses, our first witness today. We'll be able to discuss that in more detail for you. The reason for coming to you today and requesting this ADP is that this is obviously a large project. It's an important one for both companies. The Big Stone plant is the largest single resource for both Montana, Dakota, and for Otter Tail. It supplies roughly 39% of the North Dakota customer annual energy requirement for Otter Tail and approximately 25% of that requirement for MDU. There's obviously a long lead time in a project of this scale. It's very important to both companies that they are able to obtain some regulatory certainty so that they can proceed readily and efficiently to obtain access to capital and to the vendors and the others that will be necessary to make this project a reality. They have applied in 2011, as you know. They applied in May of this year and are looking for a determination so that they can proceed with the project on the schedule that you'll hear from Mark Rolfs. If the ADP were denied, and if the AQCS in particular were not to go forward, it could have some very serious consequences for both companies and their customers. It could mean that they would lose access to a very valuable plant site at Big Stone, and that could result in higher cost and more uncertainty for both companies and their customers. We also take into account and cover this in our testimony that any alternative resource would not only be expensive, but it might not be ready in time for a compliance deadline, which we'll have testimony later that will indicate that it is expected that EPA will take final action on the South Dakota SIP by the end of March 2012, which would mean that the 5 years from that period would run in March of 2017. The evidence that I think you'll hear today will show that the AQCS is a reasonable and the lowest cost option. And we think we established that through the evidence that it is the lowest cost by a substantial margin. It's an existing and large and well-operated facility with a significant remaining life. In the analysis, the companies did consider what the alternatives would be. Some of the options, like new nuclear or coal, did not seem to be viable. The three options or alternatives that were considered, and this would be in the analysis from Burns and McDonald, were to repower the Big Stone plant with natural gas, to build a new combined cycle gas plant, or to build a new combined cycle and combine that with wind. We did a comparative economic analysis that we'll cover in the testimony again from Jeff Kopp, where we look at initial capital cost, O&M cost, and the other factors to give you some sense about how the proposed project would stack up against the alternatives. when we complete that analysis, what our testimony will show is that the proposed project is 42% less expensive than the next lowest cost option, which was in the Burns and Mack analysis, the new combined cycle and wind. They also have tested that against a wide variety of sensitivity analyses, including a capital cost range of plus and minus 30%, fuel cost of plus and minus 20%, and O&M cost of plus and minus 20%. As Mr. Kopp can explain, the analysis was done with a number of very conservative assumptions that favor the alternatives to the proposed project, and in spite of that, it still came out by a substantial margin as the lowest cost option. Backing that up is also the IRP analyses that have been provided by both companies. Otter Tail's IRP did 22 different scenarios, and in 21 of those, the proposed project was the lowest cost option. The only exception to that was one that was entirely dependent upon market purchases. MDU similarly did their analysis, and they found that under all scenarios, the proposed project was the least cost option. We will provide testimony in response to the advocacy staff's witness, Richard Hahn. The companies would note that Mr. Hahn has agreed that the proposed project is the preferred option, that the estimated cost for the proposed project are comparable to other projects of its kind around the country, and that the South Dakota Department of Environment and Natural Resources has selected reasonable technologies in order to comply with the BART requirements. So, Your Honor, at this time I would just like to briefly identify the witnesses that we intend to call today and talk about the exhibits that we intend to offer. Your Honor, we will have four witnesses who will be appearing on behalf of both companies, so as joint witnesses. Those include Mark Rolfes, who's the manager of generation development at Otter Tail Power. He's also the project manager for the Big Stone AQCS project. Terry Grauman, who is the manager of environmental services. Your Honor, with your leave, we'd also like to bring forward someone who has not filed pre-filed written testimony. That's Stacy Hebert. She's the manager of supply services. We'd like to offer her because we believe that there is interest in issues pertaining to fuel and rail rates, and she would be able to address those issues. But if leave was granted, we would propose to have her as our third witness and appearing jointly for both companies. And then our final witness, a joint witness, is Jeffrey Kopp, as I mentioned, an engineer from Burns and McDonald. He is the manager of the project development unit of the Energy Consulting Department of the Business and Technology Services Division of Burns and Mack. And he's responsible for what in the application was Attachment 9, the economic analysis. Then after those four witnesses, Your Honor, we have one witness for Otter Tail Company, Ward Uttergrud, the Senior Vice President. He will be addressing the proposed conditions to the ADP that have been offered by the advocacy staff's witness, Richard Hahn. And we have available today, but are not intending to call, Brian Draxton, who's in charge of resource planning at Otter Tail, but he could be available if that would be of interest to address issues pertaining to the IRP for Otter Tail. Then finally, for Montana Dakota, Andrea Stomberg, the Vice President of Electrical Supply, she will also be addressing the proposed conditions to the ADP, as well as the role of the Big Stone plant in the generation fleet for MDU, and Darcy Nigam, who is System Operations and Planning Manager. He will be prepared to address the IRP for MDU. In terms of the exhibits, we do have 30 exhibits that we intend to offer for the record. The great majority of them consist of the application, which I'll come back to in just a moment. The other two parts of the exhibits are the pre-filed testimony of the witnesses that I just listed, and also the IRP documents from both companies. We have provided to Your Honor and to the commissioners a notebook that has our exhibits in it. In the front of that, I think you'll find an exhibit list that we've prepared that contains all of these exhibits. You'll notice that the joint exhibits are prefixed OTP MDU, and then that's the 100 series. The 200 series is for the otter tail exhibits. The 300 series is for the MDU exhibits. The 400 series has been reserved for advocacy. I might note for the record, we do have some trade secret material. We haven't supplied that, of course, in the room. It consists of five of the attachments. Those are attachment 4, which is exhibit 105. On your exhibit list, that's been marked as 105A. Attachment 5, attachment 8, I'm sorry, attachment 6, attachment 8, and attachment 9 are all trade secret. Also, there's very limited trade secret material in the testimony of Mr. Hahn and Mr. Kopp. Your Honor, at this point, and after the close of opening statements, we'll be ready to present our case, but we appreciate your time today.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll be very brief. Good morning. As you are all aware, well aware, today's hearing concerns whether the Big Stone AQCS project is prudent. Although there remains a distinct possibility that advocacy staff will support the companies in this matter, we nevertheless welcome this opportunity to help provide to you the most full and complete record practical. As far as our witnesses, advocacy staff intends to call Mr. Richard Hahn. As far as our exhibits, we have 4. ADV-401 is comprised of the public version of Richard Hahn's pre-filed testimony. 401A is the non-public, unredacted version of the same testimony, and that will be 401A. 402 is comprised of a large volume of documents, several spreadsheets, and a number of FERC Form 1s from MDU. And ADV-403 is a discovery request, LCA-3-1, and that comprises advocacy staff's exhibits. So, as Mr. Brown had indicated, thank you for your time.
I understand for the record that Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco will not make an opening statement. Mr. Brown, you may proceed.
Your Honor, at this time, we would like to move the admission of exhibits. We have conferred with counsel, and I believe we have a stipulation in place that would provide for the admission of the exhibits that appear on the exhibit list that is in front of you and the commissioners. So at this time, I'd like to move first for the admission of exhibits Otter Tail MDU 101 through 115A.
Mr. Grumman?
No objection, Your Honor.
That is, you join in the stipulation.
Correct.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I have no objection.
You join in the stipulation for the admission of the exhibits identified by Mr. Brown?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Grumman, I'm sorry, Mr. Brown?
And, Your Honor, I have some further exhibits if I could move them as well, please.
Please.
We also have the exhibits for Otter Tail Power Company. Those are exhibits 201 through 204. I'd like to move for their admission at this time.
Mr. Grumman?
The staff so stipulates.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Also.
Exhibits are received.
And, Your Honor, thank you. And finally, we'd like to also move for the exhibit of the MDU exhibits 301 through 305.
Mr. Grumman?
Staff stipulates that as well.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
As does advisory staff.
Exhibits are received, and I think for the record, I did not state the receipt of exhibits OTP MDU 101 through 115.
115A, Your Honor.
115A. Those are also received pursuant to the stipulation. Does that complete your offer of the exhibits?
It does, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Grumman.
Likewise, the ABC staff offers ADV 401, 401A, 402, and 403 in the record.
Mr. Brown.
Your Honor, we are prepared to stipulate to their admission.
Yes. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
We agree.
Exhibits are each received. Now, Mr. Brown, back to you.
And Your Honor, if I just on one matter on the exhibits for advocacy staff, the one that pertains to the spreadsheet, if I can ask counsel to confer, is that 402?
Correct.
Exhibit 402, we would like to limit our stipulation to the information pertaining to the Big Stone and the Coyote plants, and I understand that's agreeable to counsel.
Mr. Grumman?
It is agreeable, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
It is.
The limitation is acknowledged for the record. Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. At this time, we're prepared to call our first witness, and that would be Mark Rolfes.
Please be seated, Mr. Rolfes. I almost hate to do this, but indeed, as you know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I am required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Ross, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you please state your full name for the record?
Mark Rolfes.
And who is your employer?
I'm employed by Otter Tail Power Company.
And what is your position there?
My title is Manager Generation Development, and I'm acting as the project manager for the Big Stone Air Quality Control System project.
And Mr. Rolfes, I think you'll find in front of you a document, and this has been distributed to the commissioners, to the judge, and to counsel. It's titled Applications and Supporting Materials. Do you have that in front of you?
Yes, I do.
And Your Honor, I think on the agreement that we reached earlier that I'd like to be able to discuss this to proceed quickly, but the intention here is to offer this as an organizing document for the application for both companies. So I just wanted to reference that briefly with Mr. Rolfes.
Yes.
Okay. So Mr. Rolfes, the application that was submitted by both companies consisted of a series of documents. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And if we could quickly just identify those for the record. Both companies submitted an application. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And those have been marked as Otter Tail Exhibit 202 and MDU Exhibit 302. Is that right?
That's correct.
And then moving to the supporting materials, there was a Big Stone project description that was provided. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I just note for the record that that's been marked as exhibit, joint exhibit, so Otter Tail MDU 102. And Mr. Rolfes is the sponsoring witness for that. Then there was a discussion of the reasonableness of the proposed project. Is that right?
That's correct.
And that's found in exhibit 103?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the next document in the supporting materials is an assessment of the financial and operational impacts of pending environmental regulations. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're also the sponsoring witness for that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Then we move to three exhibits that pertain to the regulations, the first one being the South Dakota Regional Hay SIP. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's Exhibit 111?
Yes.
Sorry. Yes, it is.
And then there's an assessment of anticipated federal and state environmental regulations that's been marked as Exhibit 112?
That's correct.
And followed by the South Dakota Regional Haze Administrative Rules, marked as 113.
That's correct.
And then there are a series of attachments that came with that I believe you were involved in the preparation of. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And the first one is the SOX, NOX, and Mercury Reduction Study, marked as Exhibit 105. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you briefly describe what that document is?
This is the summation of the work done by our consulting engineer, and in this case it was Sergeant Alundi, that came up with the conceptual design for the proposed air quality control system project at the plant.
Thank you. And there's a trade secret version of that document that's been marked as Exhibit 105A?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the next document on the list is the project cost estimate. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you briefly describe that document?
That is a fairly large document that gives the cost estimate for the plant, or for, excuse me, for the project. It's broken down into the systems and quite detailed as to how we came up with the cost estimate that we're presenting.
And that's been marked as Exhibit 106 with a trade secret version 106A. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Then the next document is the AQCS operating and maintenance cost calculation. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you briefly describe that document?
That's the document where we present the information on the expected change in the cost to operate and maintain the Big Stone unit with the addition of the air quality control system.
And that's been marked as Exhibit 107 with a trade secret version at 107A?
That's correct.
The next document is the AQCS contract cost strategy. Is that right?
Yes.
And can you describe that document, please?
This is the document that explains the approach that we are taking for the contracting of the project. I mean, how we're going to deliver it, procure the equipment, procure the construction and such, and why we feel that the approach we're taking is the most cost-effective in today's market.
And that's been marked as Exhibit 108?
That's correct.
The next document is the natural gas conversion study. Is that right?
That's correct.
And can you briefly describe that document?
As we looked at alternatives, and we'll probably talk about this as the morning progresses, excuse me, one of the alternatives we considered was just the removal of coal from the existing boiler and replacing it with natural gas. And this was the study that examined that and came up with the feasibility and the cost if we pursued that option.
And that's been marked as Exhibit 109 with a trade secret version at 109A?
Correct.
The next document is the Burns & McDonald AQCS pro forma economic analysis. Is that right?
That's right.
And what is that document?
Of the options that we felt we needed to consider as we evaluated the AQCS project, we came up with four options, and we gave those to Burns & McDonald to do an economic analysis of to determine what's the least cost option.
And that document has been marked as Exhibit 115 with a trade secret version at 115A?
That's correct.
And then the last document is Montana Dakota's assessment of pending environmental regulations. Is that right?
That's correct.
Can you describe that document?
Mr. Nigam would be better suited to describe that.
Okay. And that, just for the record, I would note that that's been marked as MDU 304, Your Honor. So thank you. Mr. Rolfes, could you describe the major components of the AQCS, please?
Excuse me. The proposed AQCS project is addressing three pollutants, SO2, NOx, and particulate matter, and I'd like to go through it in each one of those components. The equipment that is being proposed to address the SO2, or the sulfur dioxide, is a scrubber. The South Dakota requirements stipulate that the control device has to be a dry or a semi-dry scrubber. Just briefly explain that jargon. A semi-dry scrubber is a type of scrubber that is on the Antelope Valley Station or the Coyote Station in North Dakota. It's a system where lime is slurried and sprayed into the exhaust gases to control SO2, and it's very common. And that's referred to as semi-dry. You start with a wet product and end up with a dry product. The dry scrubber is very similar, except you begin with a dry product, lime, and it's put in a circulating fluidized bed, and the water is added to the existing bed in the flue gas stream. So you have no wet material to begin with. It's dry product going in and dry product coming out, and is referred to as a dry scrubber. That is what is being proposed to address the SO2. For the NOx, we are proposing, or the South Dakota regulation requires two pieces of equipment or systems to address the nitric oxides. First, what's referred to as a separated overfire air system that would be installed on the boiler. This directs some of the combustion air above the primary combustion area, and by doing this, we reduce the amount of NOx that is produced. The second control device, which is the larger, more complicated, costly one, is a selective catalytic reduction unit, an SCR unit, that's placed at the exit of the boiler before the air heater, and it's very similar to the catalytic converter on your car. You inject ammonia, and in the presence of the catalyst, the NOx reacts, and you end up with N2 nitrogen and water vapor. So you break apart or destroy the nitrogen oxides that are the present. And the final part of that is particulate control. And this one is a little bit confusing because the current Big Stone unit has a baghouse on the unit, and the baghouse is the control device necessary for controlling particulates per the BART requirements. However, the existing Big Stone baghouse is a retrofitted baghouse that was put inside the original housing for the precipitator that the unit had when it was built, and it is operating at the maximum design pressure, actually vacuum, that the unit can withstand. By adding a SCR and a scrubber in front of the baghouse, we will approximately double the negative pressure in the existing baghouse if we do not replace it. One of the first things we did in the engineering work is we looked at the feasibility of reusing the existing baghouse, and to do that, it would have to be structurally reinforced and repaired. And to make a long story short, the engineering analysis showed it would be much more cost-effective to build a new baghouse than to try and upgrade the existing baghouse to withstand the pressure and requirements with the other pollution control devices added. So our proposed project includes a new baghouse for particulate control because it's more cost-effective than the reuse of the existing baghouse.
Mr. Rolfes, could I ask you to pull out Exhibit 102? It has been provided. It should be the second folder there, I think, and it's in the notebooks that have been provided to the judge and the commissioners, and that is the description of the Big Stone project. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And if I could refer you to page 8 for a moment and the schematic on that page. And maybe I'd just call attention to this, if you could use this to help us all get our bearings in terms of where the different parts of the AQCS would be installed at the Big Stone plant. Again, that's page 8 at Exhibit 102.
What appears on page 8 is, of course, a 3D model, computer-generated model of the proposed equipment. And just as reference, basically everything that's green is existing equipment. You can recognize that the taller building as being the boiler house with the turbine generator bay in front of it. Everything that's not green is part of the new equipment. Directly behind the boiler and between the boiler building and the stack is where the new SCR would go. The distinguishing feature of the SCR, it's basically a big box, but because of where it has to sit in the flue gas stream, it has to operate at a particular temperature. It has to be very close to the boiler. In the case of the Big Stone unit, because it's designed, it sits very high in the air. The top of the SCR is approximately 250 feet in the air. So it's a very large structure, even though it's basically just a large box, and it's in a turquoise bluish color. Then on the bottom or below is where the scrubber and baghouse would go. This particular drawing shows a particular vendor for the scrubber and baghouse, but the vendor has not been chosen. The new scrubber and baghouse is being proposed to sit directly, we refer to as plant south. The exhaust gases would come out of the boiler, take a turn, and go out and through the scrubber vessels, the baghouse, and then through ID fans and go back to the existing stack. In the very foreground is where the limestone ammonia storage area would be.
Thank you. Who was responsible for preparing the cost estimate for the proposed AQCS?
Well, it was my responsibility, and we hired Sergeant Lundy to do that.
And how was the cost estimate developed?
It was a fairly long process. First, Sergeant Lundy began by doing a screening study to answer some of the basic questions, like what's the best location for the SCR? Can we reuse the baghouse? Once the screening study was done, then we went on and did a conceptual design to come up with, you know, how how big the SCR would have to be, how high, you know, all the design parameters were calculated and compiled. Once that was done, then we actually got into the actual cost estimate, and that was done by looking through basically two means. One was Sergeant Lundy's database on all the projects they've done, and they have done more of these projects than any other engineering firm in the country, and by getting cost estimates for all the major pieces of equipment. We then took this very detailed cost estimate and the indicative bid prices from vendors and combined them. And then this project, we actually went a step further because the construction portion is, the largest single cost. After Sergeant Lundy had completed the cost estimates, we then went out to one of the major construction companies and had them give a cost estimate to do the project. And their cost estimate and the number that Sergeant Lundy had come up with were very close. This was all compiled to produce the cost estimate that is in this application.
And what is the estimated cost for the proposed project?
For the AQCS system, it's approximately $489 million. For the mercury control, that's an additional roughly $5 million.
And can you explain the purpose of the mercury controls?
The mercury controls, maybe back up, the air quality control project is being done to address the South Dakota BART SIP requirements, and Mr. Grumman will get into those. But the mercury control was engineered and planned in anticipation of the utility MACT, Maximum Achievable Control Technology rules that are supposed to be finalized in December. And the time frame would be the same as the AQCS system. And the purpose is to control mercury and other hazardous air pollutants. And so because of the timing and the likelihood of those regulations, we did the engineering to incorporate the MACT controls, mercury controls, as well, and with the air quality control system project.
What have the owners of the plant done to ensure the lowest reasonable cost?
Well, there are a number of steps that are taken. One of them we've touched on already is the contracting method, and that's probably the largest single thing we can do. Right now, it is a buyer's market for these types of projects. Because of the economy and some of the uncertainty, there's quite an interest from vendors and contractors to do this work. So we have come up with the hybrid approach, which allows us to get to the market sooner for the procuring of this equipment. The biggest feature of getting to the market soon is because of the proposed MAC regulations and the what's referred to as the cross-state air pollution or CASPER rules, which once they are finalized will create a huge demand for similar types of equipment. And in the past, we've seen the costs escalate tremendously during these bubbles that are caused by new regulations. So the contracting method, the project delivery method, was trying to take advantage of the current market. Beyond that, you know, we are doing the competitive bidding process to ensure we have the lowest cost, and we're, you know, it sounds cliche, but we are aggressively managing the project to ensure that we get the best value for our customers.
Can you briefly describe the implementation schedule?
Very quickly, the project has already been in the works for roughly 2 years. The work that was done to do the screening study and conceptual design and to get to this point have taken about 2 years of work. Going on from where we are today, we are in the process of negotiating the first major supply contracts. Because of the long lead times, we're prepared to enter into those very soon with limited notice to proceed. The detailed engineering has started to support that procurement work, and the bulk of the procurement will be completed in 2012, so that by late summer, early fall, we can go on to the market to get the erection contractor. And so that contractor can be selected by the beginning of 2013. Then construction would start as soon as possible in the spring of 2013, with roughly a two-year construction window to erect all of this material, and targeting a tie-in outage in the spring of 2015 to coincide with a planned major outage of the unit. And then we're looking at the remainder of 2015 and to early 2016 for startup, tuning, testing, shakedown, so that the unit is ready to operate in 2016.
What would be the consequences if the companies were unable to adhere to the schedule that you just laid out?
Well, basically, there are two consequences, cost and compliance. And I think the bigger issue, which I've talked about, is the cost. We are in a very good time frame to be doing this work, and delay will drive up the cost. If the past bubbles are any indication, a one-year delay could easily increase the cost by 20%. So, you know, that the biggest issue is, of course, cost. Excuse me. The second one, of course, is compliance. Like Mr. Brown read from the South Dakota rules, we are obligated to do this as soon as practical, but we do have the end date 5 years after the EPA SIP approval that the unit would have to stop operating if this isn't in place, which could be extremely costly if we don't make that and we have to go to the market for replacement power.
Mr. Rolfes, the company retained Burns McDonald to do an economic analysis of the project and alternatives. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Can you briefly describe their analysis?
Mr. Kopp can go into great detail on it, but basically, after reviewing the options for Big Stone, we came up with four options. The proposed AQCS project, repowering with natural gas, just taking the coal out and putting gas in, and then replacing the unit with a large combined cycle, and also then that combined cycle paired with wind. Like Mr. Brown said in his opening statement, we looked at other things, but nothing seemed to be able to meet the functionality of the existing unit. Those four options were then given to Burns and McDonald to do a levelized cost analysis, basically an economic pro forma that came up with a single number, you know, cost per megawatt hour over the period that was investigated so that the projects could be easily and directly compared.
And the Burns and Mac analysis has been provided at Exhibit 115, is that correct?
That's correct.
That's the document you were just referring to?
Yes.
Okay. And finally, Mr. Rolfes, can you discuss the assumptions that were made by Burns and McDonald regarding the federal protection tax credit?
Yes. You know, one of the options included wind, and for all of the options, all the options and sensitivities where wind was investigated, we made the assumption that the production tax credit would continue. We took a number of assumptions that were conservative or favored the alternatives, and I think the PTC was one of those where we assumed it would be continued. I think there's good reason to question whether it will or won't with the current economic conditions, but we used the PTC and all the analysis done.
Your Honor, this time we'd like to offer this witness for cross-examination.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. It indicates in your application that SCR only works well within specified temperature ranges, and that a number of changes to the boiler are necessary to ensure that proper temperatures are maintained. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is that the case for SNCR technology as well?
I believe so, yes.
If you'd please explain.
The reaction that we're looking for, you know, it's a chemical reaction. It happens best at a particular temperature range. And for an SCR that is at a temperature range that is lower than the temperature that is seen at times from the Big Stone boiler.
What is the difference in cost between SCR and SNCR technology?
We didn't analyze SNCRs. That was not an option for this project. I know that the ongoing operation and maintenance costs are somewhat similar because you're, again, using a consumable, but we didn't analyze that because that wasn't an option for us.
It's my understanding, though, I believe in the South Dakota State Implementation Plan that there is an indication of costs for both. And if I remember correctly, SNCR is around the $11 million range, and SCR is around in the 80s. Does that sound correct?
That sounds reasonable. I mean, there's a lot less capital investment for an SNCR than an SCR.
And that's a good segue to my next question. I mean, could you please explain to the commissioners why the differentiation in cost between the two?
In very simple terms, an SNCR is you are injecting the ammonia directly into the gas stream without the presence of the catalyst. The SCR adds the catalyst, like the catalytic converter, you know, under your car, so you can get much greater NOx removal in the presence of the catalyst than you can without that catalyst present.
And is the catalyst, is that part of the cost increase for the SCR versus the SNCR?
That is almost the entire thing. I mean, the catalyst is what resides in those big boxes that I tried to point out on the drawing.
Okay. What is the catalyst, perchance? What is that material?
It's a vanadium-type compound. I can get you the answer, but I don't.
Okay, thanks. Now, OTP operates the Coyote facility as well. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And as with Big Stone, both are jointly owned and at least in part by OTP and MDU. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Could you please explain to the commission the similarities between the Coyote plant and the Big Stone plant in summary?
First, let me set the stage. I mean, Big Stone was built 6 years earlier than Coyote. And because of what transpired in 6 years, that accounts for most of the differences. The actual boiler is very similar. The turbine generator is almost identical. The differences come about because of what transpired in 6 years and the location. The biggest difference is Coyote has a scrubber on it. Big Stone does not have a scrubber on it. The other very obvious difference is the type of cooling. Big Stone has a cooling pond, and the plant has its own lake, and is a zero discharge where no water goes back to any stream. Coyote, because of the availability of the water from the Missouri River and such, is a little bit more common. It has a cooling tower, and it has a discharge back to the Missouri River. Those are the biggest differences. If you look at the plant, it looked very similar. Many of the same drawings were used.
How about fuel source? Is that different between the two plants? And if so, could you please explain?
Well, of course, the fuel has always been different. Coyote is a mine mouth plant. Big Stone is a plant that has rail delivery. Big Stone's first 20 years were on lignite coal. Since 1995, it has been on Powder River Basin subbituminous coal.
Could you please explain to the commission what NOx controls do you currently have in place at the Coyote plant?
Basically none.
Obviously, you're aware of the fight between the Department of Health and the EPA right now. And what's the future for NOx controls for Coyote? Do you have any thoughts in that regard? And if so, please explain.
Well, we are here, and Mr. Grumman can go into great detail on this, but we're here because of regional haze requirements. And the plants that are subject to regional haze are based on a time frame when they were permitted. Big Stone falls in that time frame. Leland Olds, Milner Young fall into that time frame. Coyote does not. So the rules that Big Stone and the North Dakota plants are trying to address today don't affect Coyote because it was permitted after the cutoff date.
Is there any chance that could be changed in the future?
Anything's possible in the future.
Sure. Now, as I indicated before, there's this disagreement between the North Dakota Department of Health and the EPA. It's our understanding, at least in summary, if you can simplify such a subject, that the Department of Health its determination that BART for lignite plants does not include SCR technology. Do you understand that?
Yes.
And do you agree with the Department of Health in that situation that SCR should not be implemented for lignite plants?
The my understanding, again, Mr. Grumman can elaborate on this, the test is a cost-effectiveness test. You know, how much does it cost to remove a ton of NOx? And based on what I've seen from the North Dakota Department of Health, their number, which they are using to justify why the North Dakota plants shouldn't, that same number would say that Big Stone should have an SCR. So based on what the Department of Health has said, I believe that they would, if Big Stone was sitting on the other side of the border, would say the exact same thing that South Dakota said, that an SCR is required for Big Stone based on the statements they've made.
So essentially, if I understand correctly, I don't put words in your mouth, essentially the SCR technology for lignite coal plants is just not efficient enough?
I would use the term it's not cost-effective.
Now, as you had indicated, the South Dakota State Implementation Plan for the Regional Haze Rule indicated that SCR and separative odorifier air is NOx BART for Big Stone. That's correct?
That's correct.
And as indicated before, one of the differences between the Big Stone plant and the Kyle plant is the fuel differentiation, and that Kyle is lignite and Big Stone is Powder River Basin coal. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But as you also indicated, Big Stone used to be powered by lignite. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And when well was that changeover? Was that about 1995? Is that what you indicated? Or
yes.
So I guess the question arises is that, in hindsight, if that changeover hadn't been made from lignite or from lignite coal to Powder River Basin coal and Big Stone, right now for the AQCS project, we'd be looking at SNCR technology rather than SCR technology.
Your Honor, object on relevance.
Well, Your Honor, what I would indicate is that, of course, as indicated, Coyote Plant and Big Stone Plant have a number of same similarities. Both companies operate them. Really, the only differentiation, of course, is the fuel source, but we're here today for prudence and skill adjustment.
Overruled. You may proceed.
I think that's a gross oversimplification. You have to remember Big Stone was, when it was operating on lignite, was the only plant that had a rail haul for lignite. All of the lignite units are mine mouth, and Big Stone was not competitive with lignite and a rail haul. If we had stayed with lignite, we would have not been competitive. Our customers would have been paying a premium since 1995 for that. Also, it is my opinion, and this is all opinion, that we would have been, in effect, in front of this commission in 2000, because at that point in time on lignite, we would be facing the same thing we are today with putting a scrubber on the unit. And we have to remember that the scrubber is the bigger cost of the AQCS. And we would have been facing that decision in 2000, not 15 years later.
Now, on page 16 of your application, that's Exhibit OTP MDU 104, you indicate an expected net dispatchable energy generation of 3,120,750 megawatt hours, which equates to a capacity factor of about 75%. Does that sound correct?
That's correct.
Now, if you ran Big Stone without any type of load following, what capacity factor do you think could technically be achievable post AQCS?
Well, there's a number of questions in that question. Mm-hmm. First, we believe and we're designing the AQCS to not affect the ability of Big Stone to run. It's not going to be less reliable, etc. So the plant is capable and has run close to 90% capacity factor if there was no economic dispatch, etc. So I would expect that the plant would be capable of running a 90% capacity factor if we didn't have to worry about costs.
Thank you. According to MDU's filed FERC Form 1s, it appears that you achieved an overall capacity factor at Big Stone of about 66% and 68% in 2009 and 2010, respectively. Does that seem about right to you?
No. I would argue that the Form 1 is right, but that is MDU's number. You have to remember that the plant is jointly owned, and the 75% capacity factor that we used is not only our projection forward, but it is almost exactly looking backward and what the plant has averaged for the past 5 years.
Okay, so if that 66% and 68% are incorrect, what would those values be?
Well, they are correct for MDU. Each owner can dispatch the unit as they see fit, but we're here talking about the entire plant, and the entire plant's capacity factor is very, very close to the 75% number that we used in our economic analysis.
Are you familiar with what then OTPs, FERC Form 1s, were in that regard?
I know they're a little bit higher than MDUs.
Who ultimately pays for unused capacity?
Well, the answer is pretty simple. It's pretty simple. At the end of the day, the ratepayers pay for whatever we build.
Now, it's my understanding that coal plants in particular are very expensive to run at a capacity factor of less than 70%. Would you agree?
Depends upon the very expensive. It's not as economical to run it below.
If you could please expand upon that.
Well, the plant heat rate, the term we use for the amount of coal or energy it takes to produce a kilowatt hour, is best at a load, and depends upon the plant condition, but best at a load that's close to full output of the unit. And as the unit produces less electricity, its heat rate goes up. It takes more energy, and it's a curve. It's not a step function. So, I mean, there isn't a place where it drops off. The lower load, the more expensive it is. It's a gradual decline in performance.
Now, before you had testified, I'm going back to the capacity factor, that Big Stone had an average of about 75%. Mm-hmm. However, if there were no load following, 90% could technically be achievable. Why the differentiation of the two values?
Because we live in the real world where load varies and resource, and now with the addition of wind, resources vary. And, you know, as an electric utility and as MISO, the operator of the electrical system, we have to balance load and demand. And, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning on a nice fall day, there's not a lot of demand as opposed to 95 degrees in summer. So the reality, we have to have resources that ramp up and ramp down as the load and the supply changes.
Well, clearly you have a number of years of experience. Before, you had mentioned in your answer about wind. If you could expand upon that, how does wind in particular affect the capacity factor of a coal-fired plant?
Well, the idea is to always dispatch the cheapest resource, and that, in very simple terms, is based on the variable cost or the fuel cost. It's not based on a day-to-day basis on how expensive the plant was to build. It's based on how expensive it is to run. And with the addition of wind, because it has virtually no fuel cost and only small variable O&M cost, when wind is available, it is dispatched first because zero cost or very low cost. So when wind is available, it's used, and other resources have to back off if there's not sufficient load.
If you could expand upon that, you were talking about how wind is dispatched because it's least cost. What is all apart? What is that predicated upon as far as cost? Is it just fuel?
It's basically the variable costs, which are primarily fuel.
Now, as indicated before, the FERC Form 1 filings from MDU indicates that a 10-year capacity average of Big Stone is about 74%, 75%. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
If you could please explain, in your application you indicate that post-AQCS, that 75% rating is still going to be able to be achieved. Could you explain just how exactly that's going to take place?
Well, there's two pieces of that. One is we are not our engineering and this project is being put together so that we, by the addition of this equipment, do not affect the ability to do what's required. I mean, we're not going to compromise the ability of the unit to produce because of it. The other piece of that is a little bit more speculative, and what is the market going to be? And we could spend a lot of time speculating. Is the market such that with the coming of MACT regulations and CASPER that older coal units will be retired and the demand for the existing baseload units go up? Or is the future that there's a lot more wind built and that the Big Stone, the existing baseload units, are backed off more? I mean, it's a crystal ball analysis, but it seemed very feasible that with the likely retirement of marginal coal units and returning to more normal economic growth, that Big Stone would certainly be able to maintain its capacity factor that it's seen. Maybe it will increase, but again, that's the more speculative side of the two pieces.
Thank you. According to MDU's FERC Form 1s for the Coyote Station, the plant enjoyed a capacity factor of 83% during 2010 and average capacity factor of 82% for the last 10 years. Do you have an opinion as to what might be causing the runtime differential between Coyote and Big Stone? And if so, please explain.
Well, let me give you what I look at, again, on the total plant, and I looking back in the last 10 years, Coyote's capacity factor from looking at the total plant is about 3% higher than Big Stone's, 3% higher capacity factor. The other thing that you have to remember, because of the nature of the fuel and such, Big Stone's cruise rating is roughly 10% higher than Coyote's. So even though Coyote's capacity factor may be higher, Big Stone is producing more megawatt hours, especially more megawatt hours when it, on peak, than what Coyote is. So the reason Coyote's capacity factor is higher, is higher, is because its variable cost, its fuel cost, is a little bit lower. But the other side of it, Big Stone is producing more megawatt hours in the year. So it's kind of a horse apiece.
Well, it's kind of intriguing. You're talking about cruise factor. Could you please explain that further?
Cruise rating, cruise factor, is the level of generation that the plant will produce day in, day out, if called to do. And Big Stone's is higher, and a lot of that is to do with the fuel it's burning. So when we ask the plants to produce full load because it's a hot day in July, Big Stone will be producing about 50 megawatts more than what Coyote is.
As I understand the MISO energy market you participate in, generation units are bid into the market on a daily basis, and the cheapest units needed to meet the electric demands of the day are then dispatched. Is that essentially correct?
Yes.
According to the FERC file, FERC 1 filed by MDU, the production expense, fuel costs, and O&M to run the plant is consistently lower for Coyote when compared to Big Stone, about 17% lower on average over the last 10 years. Given your understanding of how MISO works, wouldn't you expect Coyote to run more often because it is a cheaper resource?
Yes, and that's why the capacity factor is 3% higher.
What are the main drivers causing the difference in production expense, whereby Coyote consistently outperforms Big Stone in a cost per megawatt hour?
Again, it's the fuel cost. Coyote is a mine-mouth plant. Big Stone has a rail delivery.
Just one moment, Your Honor. On page 14 of your application, that's Joint Exhibit Number 2, OTP MDU 103, it is stated that Big Stone is frequently used for load following. You also talk about load following that is necessary to accommodate peak periods of use during the day and the lower energy needs at night. Is this correct?
That's correct.
Would you also agree that load following also occurs because of the vast amounts of intermittent resources in the Dakotas and Minnesota that have come online over the past several years?
I would definitely agree with that.
You could please expand. Why do you agree?
Well, in the past, we had basically one variable, and that was load. You know, load changed with weather and time of day and such. Now we've added a second variable into the equation, and that is these intermittent resources that are dependent upon when the wind blows. So there are now two variables in the equation, and they don't necessarily move in the same direction. So the need to respond to changes is greater through the whole MISO system.
Are you familiar with the Buffalo Ridge project in Minnesota?
Well, I mean, it's a number of projects, but
certainly.
Yes.
If you could please explain, what's your understanding of Buffalo Ridge?
Well, Buffalo Ridge is a geological formation that starts in Minnesota and continues up into South Dakota and then and towards North Dakota, and there's a vast amount of wind turbines that have been located on the Buffalo Ridge.
You have an understanding of about how many megawatts we're talking about in Buffalo Ridge? Or?
No, I don't.
Well, in particular, I guess what I'm getting at is, obviously, Buffalo Ridge is fairly proximate to Big Stone, is that correct?
Yes, geographically, yes.
How in particular, or specifically Buffalo Ridge, how does that affect your capacity rating?
I don't think there is any direct tie. I mean, we are dispatched in the MISO system, so it's more the availability of wind through the whole system and the load for the whole system than just what is geographically close to Big Stone. If I'm understanding your question, that is.
Thank you. Now, a number of times today we've spoken about load following for a coal plant. Is a coal plant designed to run that way, or are there negatives to that? Does it reduce plant life?
Well, a coal plant can be designed for whatever you want it to do. There are a lot of units in the world that are designed to start up in the morning, come up to full load, and then be taken off at night. Big Stone Coyote were not designed for that type of load following. We don't take it on and off, but it certainly can go from full load to minimum load every day. So instead of a 0 to 100%, we have a 40% to a 100% range that the units definitely can operate very successfully in.
And in your operation of Big Stone in the last several years, are you within the design thresholds?
Yes, I mean 40 to 100% is common operation.
So if you had to describe, I mean, the effects of ramping up and ramping down within those thresholds, how has that affected plant life in your opinion?
Well, it's increasing cost, like we talked about, because of the heat rate, and the other, you know, the cycles up and down do increase the maintenance costs.
So in particular, I guess you discussed before two variables, demand and wind. How has wind in particular affected the plant life of Big Stone?
Well, there is no way as an operator to know exactly why the unit goes up or down. I mean, Big Stone from day one in 1975, when there was no wind, still did a certain amount of load following and did it in spring and fall. So the going from minimum load to full load has been common through the life of the plant. It's happening more, but is it happening more because of wind? Is it happening more because it's a poor economy? That's where it gets tough to distinguish why. I mean, we're operators. When we're told to go down, we go down. When we're told to come up, we come up. And what's really causing it? You know, because the plant did follow load from day one to some degree.
Well, clearly, what you do is in a science dependent upon a number of variables, for instance, change in natural gas prices and et cetera. Now, you indicated that you know that the capacity factor is changing, but you haven't focused on wind in particular. Has there ever been a study by MDU or OTP in this regard concerning the differentiation in your capacity factor tied specifically to wind?
I am not aware of a study that reached a concrete result.
Could you please expand upon that?
Well, I know people have looked at the issue, but I'm not aware that anybody has successfully been able to say this much, this effort is caused by wind, and this much is caused by economics, and this much is caused by weather. You know, there's just, I'm not aware of anything that has been able to pin down which factor causes what percentage of these variable changes.
Okay. When you say tied down, I mean, have there been any kind of hypothetical guesses in memorandums or anything like that in that regard?
Not that I'm aware of.
I guess just using as a common example, if you're going to a used car lot and you're buying a vehicle, one of the questions you're going to have is, okay, does this vehicle have a number of highway miles or city miles? Could you please explain why would someone ask that? And
well, I drive a van that has 203,000 miles on it, so it's a number of factors, whether it's a car or a power plant. You know, how is it used and how is it maintained? And it takes both of those. You know, as an operator, I would love to have the unit put on at full load and just run steady because it's the easiest, it's the best. But that's not the real world today. So,
Before you had testified that you weren't aware of any type of determination as far as tying wind, specifically towards the lower capacity rating for a Big Stone plant. What are your thoughts if the commission were to predicate the determination of this ADP upon having such an analysis performed by the companies? Would that be achievable?
I don't know if it would be achievable, and I don't see the relevance to the air quality project, but that's...
Certainly. Well, there's a relevancy legal determination, and then there's a technical differentiation as well. From a technical standpoint, is that something that could be accomplished?
I don't know if we could get agreement on the parameters. I mean, I'm not the study expert, but I don't know if that's going to be technically possible.
Would there be another witness present today that would be able to more fully expand upon that you're aware of?
Well, Mr. Kopp deals with many utilities. He may have some thoughts, but Mr. Ugarud, you know, is more familiar with other parts of the company than I am, but I don't know if they can shed any light that I can't.
Yeah, thank you. Going now toward the integrated resource plan, when placing wind projects into your integrated resource plan model for planning purposes, does the model consider the negative impacts wind load following has on coal generation facilities?
I'm not the expert on that. I don't believe it does, but I'm not the expert on that.
Do you know who would – is there someone that would better be able to answer that question?
Mr. Draxton okay. would be able to answer.
Just one moment, Your Honor. The application – talks about levelized costs. Can you explain what that means and how it is calculated?
Again, Mr. Kopp can go into the details, and I'm sure he can explain it better, but basically it's taking a planning period, 20 years, and doing a pro forma analysis over that and then deriving that down to a single number for comparison. I mean, in really over simple terms, and it the people who work will probably shudder, but it's coming up with an average number for the whole period. And that's certainly not technically correct, but it gives the idea.
Turning now to bag houses, it's my understanding now in the life of the plant for Big Stone, there's been a number of bag houses. What is the life expectancy of the new baghouse proposed for this AQCS project?
Well, first, I'd like to comment on a number of baghouses because there's really hasn't been a a number of bag houses. Just quick, let me go over that the Big Stone was built with an electrostatic precipitator, which was common technology at the time. The precipitator was reaching the end of its life, and subituminous coal is a more difficult coal ash to collect than lignite. So it had two, you know, it had two strikes against it. You know, the more difficult ash and aging and failing. So the owners were faced with, we had to do something. The University of North Dakota Energy Research Center approached the plant with a unique technology that, with the Department of Energy and a commercializer and the Energy Research Center, a prototype unit was installed at Big Stone trying to advance the technology. It was a combination of precipitator and baghouse, and if it had succeeded, it would have been a step forward in the use of and the cost, because you only use a fraction of the bags, and a large share of the cost was funded by the Department of Energy. Unfortunately, with all commercialization efforts, they're not all successful, and this one was not. It was able to remove the particulates, but the bag life for the bags in it was extremely short, so the plant was faced with having to do something, and that's what drove the plant to put its first bag house on, which is the one that's operating today. So we're really talking about the second bag house for Big Stone, and what's driving it is not because the existing one is not doing its job, it's because the box that it sits in was designed for a maximum of minus 25 inches. It's running at a maximum of 24 inches today, in and out. I mean, day in and day out. With the proposed air quality control system, it'll see normally minus 50 inches. The thing will implode if we don't do something, and that's why it's not practical to continue with the existing baghouse. The baghouse that we're proposing should last the life of the unit. It should certainly last 30 years. It's a proven technology. It's running on a lot of other units that have burning the same type of fuel. Long answer. I apologize.
Oh, not at all. Thank you. What exactly is the cost of the new expected baghouse?
I'll have to give you a very generalized answer, because as we look at the scrubber technology that I talked about, dry versus semi-dry, there's a trade-off. One, you have a more expensive baghouse and a cheaper scrubber, and vice versa. But basically, to put a new baghouse on with the spray dryer, we're talking roughly $30 million purchase and install cost.
Now, it's my understanding that, at least as of right now, of course, you made an application in Minnesota also for an advanced determination prudence under a different law, their law, of course. In that, proposed findings of fact, conclusions in law, and order from the ALJ, which, of course, has not been accepted by the Minnesota Commission, I believe they did not allow for the new baghouse because it was not BART. Is that your understanding? If you could please reconcile or explain.
Okay. In Minnesota, the advocacy staff is the Department of Commerce. And in Minnesota, the Department of Commerce took the position that the baghouse should be excluded. They also took the position that they're not saying Otter Tail should not be able to recover the costs for that. It's just they felt that the wording of the Advanced Determination of Prudence statute in Minnesota would exclude the baghouse. We do not necessarily agree with that position, but sometimes discretion is the better part of valor. It didn't seem worth the fight, so we have agreed that we would not oppose the Department of Commerce in that. We do not believe that they're correct. And my reading of the ALJ report, I think he takes that position in the last page of his report. It's one of those issues that, especially when they came out saying that they believe it's, in my opinion, it's a prudent expenditure, it's just not part of the way they interpret the ADP statute.
Thank you. Now, clearly there have been a number of questions and discussions about wind today. Just out of curiosity, it's my understanding the production tax credit for wind ends 2012 currently. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you have any opinions to whether or not that's going to get extended?
Well, I can give you my opinion, and I have to put the disclaimer, certainly not MDU's opinion. It's not Otter Tail's. But, I mean, I personally believe that it's either going to be not extended or greatly reduced just because of the economic condition, the concerns for balancing the budget and such. I would think there's a good chance that it will not be extended, but my opinion isn't worth anything more than anyone else's opinion.
From your understanding, I mean, is that predicated solely upon the lack of federal dollars, or are stakeholders, are there any complaints or an et cetera that the electricity system is too dynamic and it's perhaps that it can't incorporate all this extra wind? Do you have an opinion in that regard?
I'm not the resource planner. I'm the guy who's worked for 35 years in coal, so I'm very biased. I mean, I'm a coal guy. I got to admit it. That's what I've done my career, and I see wind having its place, but I don't think that the production tax credit is necessary. But like I said, I'm very biased, and you're getting my opinion, certainly not Otter Tail's opinion.
Just reiterating, I guess, some of your prior testimony. If the companies were to receive conditional ADP, what would you expect would be the project cost between now and when the EPA is likely to issue their final ruling concerning the South Dakota SIP, I believe in March 2012?
My guesstimation is that we will have spent total project by March roughly $6 million, total project.
Could you break that down, the $6 million, in regards to, for instance, construction costs versus engineering planning?
Well, there are no construction costs in that. There are no procurement. It is basically the engineering that was necessary for these types of hearings and to begin the detailed design. So it's my time, the engineer's time, and there's nothing solid. We haven't bought any steel. We haven't, we've done some exploration, bore holes in the ground and the things that are necessary to do the design work, but we haven't bought anything.
And thank you for the correction. And that's what I meant, too, as far as procurement of materials and et cetera when I said construction. So it's my understanding, then, of the $6 million, it's going to be engineering between now and March. There isn't going to be any acquisition of materials or...
The intention, the schedule, if we continue, we will enter into contracts for material, but the contracts will be limited notice to proceed so that the engineering work can start to keep the project on schedule.
Well, I know in government here, of course, our standard contracts are that there's always a caveat that if there's a lack of funding or an et cetera, that it's essentially not breach of contract and you can leave. In your type of contracts, I mean, are they written in such a way so that if the EPA were to do something unexpected and not accept the South Dakota State Implementation Plan, or if there's something that changes where you would no longer need it, is there a way that you can essentially leave your contracts without facing breach?
There will be costs of cancellation. No, I mean, we can't walk away without... Once material has been ordered and... the fabrication and such has started, there will be, in effect, penalties to be paid if we walk away from it. So it's not the same as doing engineering work that you can stop immediately. So once we will get to a point, next year where there will be penalties if something goes astray.
And more specifically, hypothetically, if this commission were to submit an order, essentially saying that to preclude any kind of engineering procurement and construction contracts until the time that the EPA formally accepts the South Dakota SIP, how would that affect you? Is that something you would be in favor of? Or if not, please explain either way.
Well, I certainly would not be in favor of. If we suspend activity for even 3 months, that 3 months could easily, not turn into 2 years. It certainly would turn into 6 months to a year. All of the work, all the estimates are very time sensitive. I mean, the procurements that we're working on now will have expired. We would probably have to go back on the street, and if the MACT rule has come about or if other developments, the price will be different. And now we're back into the arena. Will this commission, will the Minnesota Commission want to relook at this because now the price is different? And if we start that process over, I mean, it's very easy that a three-month hiatus could turn into a year to 2 years of delay and greatly increased costs.
I have a couple of questions about ultimately if the AQCS is, of course, accepted and it's something that you're building. It's my understanding that as of right now, Big Stone is a planned outage in 2015. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You also state that the 2015 maintenance will occur notwithstanding any tie-in with the AQCS project due to otherwise necessary maintenance. Is that also correct?
That's correct within reason. I mean, if we're a week late, they'll probably wait a week, but they certainly can't wait 3 months, 6 months. There's maintenance that will have to be addressed.
So essentially, in a perfect world from a planning perspective, if AQCS is accepted and you've got this maintenance, clearly you want to tie them both in 2015. Is that correct?
That's correct.
My question is, since there's this routine maintenance, is that set in stone? Does that have to incur in 2015? Or if the AQCS project were to be extended, you could tie it in. It would just be later than 2015.
Well, it's not a simple answer. You have to remember these units go a long time between major outages, and Big Stone has just completed an outage, and it does not intend to take a major outage until 2015. That's a long time to run without being able to change the tires on the car, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Because these outages are very expensive, they're all, and as you can expect, they're concentrated in spring and fall when the demand is lowest. You get in line, so to speak, with the other units in this area so that there is enough manpower, enough resources for them to take place. So if Big Stone has two factors. One, can its facilities, its equipment make it another year, which is doubtful but potential. And then the other is there a slot where we're not going to be competing with other units so that there is enough labor, manpower, resources available? So I can't say it wouldn't be possible to move, but it could be very difficult. It could be very expensive to move.
Before, you had discussed on a number of occasions that essentially if the MACT rule comes into place and et cetera, there could be a number of companies that are looking for essentially the same materials that you're looking for the AQCS. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I.e. more demand.
Right.
Now, you know, along those lines, and when the Big Stone plant is shut down, whatever it may be, where is that power? Is that going to be purchase power, or how are you going to make up that shortfall?
Well, begin with, like I said, it's always scheduled in spring and fall to minimize the needs, but each company will go out and, well, they could go to the market, but most likely they will go and get contracts to cover that. So months and months in advance, our people will be looking to purchase energy to cover that outage.
Now, clearly, purchased energy is a finite amount. I think there's a corollary between trying to acquire all of this technology, this equipment, of course, it also is finite, as with limited amount of capacity available in the MISO market. I believe there's a number of articles that indicate that there potentially it could affect perhaps the robust system for the electricity. Have there been discussions in that regard and concerns? And if so, if you could please explain that further.
Well, most of those that I have heard relate to the MACT rules, and it's based on the speculation of how many units will put equipment on versus how many older marginal units will just retire. And there's a lot of opinions out there, some that it's no problem, others it's a serious problem. And I think it is an issue that we all should be concerned about because some of the proposed EPA rules have a very tight implementation time frame that could exacerbate the problem. So, I mean, it is something to be concerned about, and that's what part of the reason we're trying to stay as much as we can ahead of the pact.
I mean, is there a potentiality of brownouts? Is that something that you've discussed internally?
I guess I would not be part of those discussions. I'm on the, you know, the project side.
Obviously, there's been a number of discussions today concerning the coyote plant. And there's also been some discussions about the change in price between SCR and SNCR technology and this whole litigation going on. From a ratepayer standpoint, our curiosity is that clearly we're here before with an ADP. If either of your principals or OTP or MDU were to change the fuel source at the coyote plant from lignite to Powder River Basin coal, is that something that the company would be open to making this ADP contingent upon them coming back for an ADP under such a circumstance, i.e. that before they would change their fuel source, they would ask this commission for an advanced determination of prudence on that issue?
I think that's a question more for Mr. Ugarud.
If I may have a moment, Your Honor.
You may.
Thank you.
In fact, Council, let's take this opportunity for a recess.
Very good.
We'll recess until 10 after 10, please. 10 after 10. All right, Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have one final question. Before, if I remember right, your testimony indicated that at peak demand, Big Stone is producing 50 more megawatts than Coyote Station. Is that correct?
Approximately 50, yes.
But it's also true that the change or the actual maximum capacity of both Big Stone and Coyote is about that same differentiation. So therefore, Big Stone isn't technically more efficient than Coyote. That probably has more to do with it. Would you agree or not agree?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, again, there's a 50 megawatt differential at peak demand between Big Stone and Coyote. However, if the rating for Coyote and Big Stone, Coyote is 414 and Big Stone is about 475. Now, before you had testified that there was different ratings and whatnot so that Big Stone could run longer and et cetera. However, is that more of an explanation for that 50 megawatt differentiation? Capacity factor?
No, I mean, capacity factor is basically that number, 475, you know, times 8,760 hours in the year, you know, becomes the max, the 100%. And then the number of capacity factor is the percentage that the unit generates versus what it theoretically could, you know, 475 all the time. So when we say it's 50%, it's generating 50% of what it theoretically could, because Big Stone is 475 and Coyote is 414. I think it's actually a little higher than that, but you know, it's 50% of the 475 or 50% of the smaller number. So you will get more megawatt hours if the cruise rating is higher. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Well, I'll reiterate, too. So there's a 50 megawatt differentiation at peak demand between the two plants. However, Big Stone is a bigger plant.
No.
So, I mean,
it's the same equipment. It's the same generator, same turbine. The difference is a lot due to the fuel. I mean, the unit runs based on where we can run continuously and produce that. Because Coyote burns a poorer fuel, it has to run at a lower rating so that it doesn't plug the boiler and such. So that difference is, there are other minor things, but it's primarily fuel related.
No further questions.
I assume Ms. Jeffcoat Sacco has no questions. Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Thank you. I do have some. no particular order, so these may be a little bit random. Can you go over for me again the hybrid procurement approach and how that would differ from a traditional procurement approach?
Well, there are basically two traditional procurement approach. One that's referred to as EPC, engineering, procurement, construction, where basically you would go to a company, a large company usually for a project like this, and say, I want you to engineer it, buy it, and build it, and give me the keys when it's done. Okay. The other approach is what's sometimes referred to as multiple prime, where you go and you get a contractor to do every piece. I'll go and buy a generator and have that company install it. I'll go buy a boiler and that company will install it. I'll buy a bag house and that company will install it. Those are kind of the two extremes. One is a turnkey, I hire Bechtel to do everything, or I hire 30 contractors to do everything. Our hybrid, and we call it because it's really halfway between, we're going out and buying the equipment through competitive process from whoever we feel is best, and we're doing that, and then we're going and hiring a single contractor to construct, erect it all. So we have a number of procurements, but only one erection contractor. And by doing that, we can go to the market sooner. If you were doing an EPC contract, you would have to do a tremendous amount of engineering work up front because you're bidding the whole process when you go out. And it would probably take 8 to 10 months longer to do all that work and then do the bidding. This way we can do the work on the equipment and get on the street for that and then do, in parallel, do the work for the erection contractor and go to this onto the street later once we know exactly what we're going to build.
Why isn't the hybrid approach typically done then, and why does it make sense in this particular case?
It all depends upon the market. In how many, is it a buyer's market? Is it a seller's market? If it's at certain times, people like EPC because if you have the time and the market's right, you can get a firm price at the start instead of in pieces. It's all dependent upon the market. At times, if it is a seller's market, you may be in a position where you wouldn't get a contractor for a large project to bid EPC. So there is no right approach. It all depends upon the conditions today. If we're back in front of this commission in 2 years with a different project, it might be a different delivery method because the market may be different. We think this is the right approach for us at this time with the market the way it is.
Okay, so and if you could just describe the market, why this, and what are the characteristics of this market that make this approach the right one?
Right now, it is a buyer's market. We are getting a much greater response from vendors, much more interest, much more competitive process than what we have saw 3-4 years ago. But we believe that it's going to change. If the MACT rules will cause a huge run-up in demand, and it could very quickly switch from a buyer's market to a seller's market.
Okay. Could you walk me through, again, the rationale, and this is from discussion that you had with Mr. Grumman, on why there would be a difference between MDU's, I can't remember if it was capacity factor in FERC Form 1, and Otter Tail's. I understand that you said it had to do with how each company dispatches, but walk me through that, why you wouldn't just have this is the capacity coming out of the plant, and both companies would have the same factor.
If I'm going into too much detail, please stop me. But basically, each company can dispatch or call upon the unit as it sees fit for its share, as long as it is above the minimum. I mean, you can't have MDU say, I don't want to run the plant, and Otter Tail says, I want to run the plant. So we establish a minimum load. And above that, then each company can say, I want to take it all or I want to take nothing above minimum. And they're free to do that. And each company will pick their resources depending upon their options. I mean, you know, MDU has Heskett and they have Lewis and Clark and, you know, and such. Otter Tail has Hoot Lake and gas turbines. And it's a different mix. You may have units that you have to run in your area because of voltage support or something else. So that each company has different options, available resources, so their choice may be different. Just as an example, you know, we'll pick on the third party in Bakestone Northwestern. For years, they had an arrangement with WAPA to market all of their energy, so they just took Bakestone and I think Coyote and says, we're going to take our full share round the clock because they had an outlet for it. So that's the extreme case. You know, Otter Tail and MDU would be backing it off as load went down. At that time, when WAPA had short of water, they took it round the clock. So there can be some extreme differences, and that can account for the difference at Bakestone because Northwestern has a larger share, a much larger share of Bakestone than Northwestern has of Coyote.
Is Northwestern is participating in this project commensurate with its investment in Bakestone?
It just doesn't have load in North Dakota.
Right, okay. Could you talk about why the Department of Commerce in Minnesota opposed the baghouse? I mean, you said that it had to do with some statutory construct. Could you just talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it's basically the way they're interpreting the ADP statute in Minnesota, and the ADP statute is not the same as North Dakota. Similar, but it is different, and they're interpreting that it's not required because the South Dakota SIP says a baghouse is BART. We don't interpret that way because the existing baghouse would need to be modified, and it's not the most cost-effective alternative. It's cheaper to build new than to modify the old. So we have differences of opinion on how the statute is interpreted.
Okay. But the Department of Commerce hasn't indicated that they're going to oppose it through traditional rate-making principles as opposed to an advanced determination.
No, in fact, to me, they have said just the opposite, that they believe it likely can be recovered through other or through traditional rate-making processes, just not the ADP as their position.
Okay. Can you run me through again the costs for the scrubber, the control systems that will be placed for the NOx, which would be the separated air system and the SCR, and then the particulate or the new baghouse?
The breakdown of that is trade secret material.
Okay.
So we'd have to.
But it's in the trade secret file?
Yes.
But in total, you said that's
$489. $489 without the mercury control.
And the $5 million mercury control. And again, the mercury control is how's that done?
It is basically activated carbon injection.
Okay. How much power is lost off the unit by implementing the QCS?
We think that I'm prefacing my remarks. I think through engineering we can improve the number, and that's the challenge, but we're looking at roughly 9 megawatts at full load to be consumed by the unit. Now, there is an offset there because the work on the boiler will actually cause some improvements in boiler efficiency.
Okay. Could you run down again the alternatives that were considered? I know they were mentioned during opening statement.
Just quickly, we tried to come up with alternatives that would match the capability and flexibility and the attributes of the Big Stone plant, and really at the end of the day, we only came up with three others in the AQCS. The simple one is just removing the coal and replacing it with natural gas.
Right.
The other is a combined cycle, and the final one is that same combined cycle but paired with wind.
There was a good deal of talk about lignite during the cross. Was lignite ever considered switching back? The switch has been made once. Gas conversion was considered.
Was not considered.
Was there a, what would be the reason that it would not be considered or just dismissed out of hand?
Well, very simple economics, the rail haul. I mean, no one is, that we're aware of, is successfully burning lignite with a rail haul. The mine that served Big Stone, you know, 15, 20 years ago has been reclaimed and shut down, too. So we'd be looking at a capital investment somewhere. And like I said, the rail haul, we believe, would make it uncompetitive.
Were any newer technologies, such as the dry fining, things like that, that have been have come about in the last 15 or so years, studied as potentially making rail haul feasible?
No.
There was some discussion that you'd had with Mr. Grumman regarding if there were conditional natures of permits that could be granted by the commission. And you had said that the reason you wouldn't support that is because it would delay your implementation for months, which would add cost. And I'm not sure if I followed that exactly. As I understand it, the commission could condition a permit in such a way that it's not a denial or an indication of the companies that you'd not proceed. It's rather a method of ratepayer protection where you might have to come for those costs through traditional rate-making principles in the same way that apparently Otter Tail acceded to in Minnesota through the DOC. Could you walk me through that again?
Well, it was my understanding from the question that I thought Mr. Gruen had asked is if we suspended all activity until we have an EPA approval. If we don't suspend activity, of course, there won't be a delay. But I understood his question was the effect if we just put everything on hold until EPA has reached its final decision.
Okay. To what degree have you, as you were considering gas conversion, considered potential for other next EPA steps, specifically carbon, and how was that factored or not into your decision-making process?
I think everyone is aware that Otter Tail operates in Minnesota and is doing a similar ADP in Minnesota where we do have to consider carbon. And part of the Burns and MAC analysis that was done looked at the range of carbon that Minnesota considers, and we saw no case where the CO2 costs, reasonable CO2 costs, would make the AQCS not the least cost option.
How high would carbon costs have to be per ton to get the cost to the point where you'd see it, you'd tip towards, say, natural gas?
Well, the problem in answering that is, you know, when do they start? Is it phased in? Are there free allowances? What's the rate of escalation? So to give a number, you know, you've got to go through all the assumptions. But you know, for the range that Minnesota requires us to, you know, we didn't see that we were getting close to the tipping point.
What is their range?
9 to 34.
So a carbon cost of up to $34 wouldn't actually cause the utility to actually change fuel sources. It would just be simply an adder onto ratepayer bills. Is that another way to interpret it?
Yes.
So there wouldn't be a quote-unquote environmental benefit. It would just be a rate increase.
My opinion, yes.
Okay, thanks. And then I just have one final question with regard to the EPA regs themselves with regard to regional haze. Would that be best addressed to you or another witness?
I think Mr. Grumman can probably do a better job.
Okay. That's all I have. Thank you.
Commissioner Kramer.
Thank you. And thanks, Mark, for your testimony and for your endurance. Of course, you're... That chair's almost, we could almost name it after you. But we do appreciate your expertise. And I might say as a statement, actually, that the issue that Commissioner Clark was pursuing a little bit with regard to the procurement process, I suspect that having the right talent on staff, it makes it a lot easier to go out and bid and purchase equipment yourself as well before bringing on a general contractor. And I just make that as a statement as I look at you, because as I listen to your testimony, I suspect that that had a fair bit to do with it. So, but with that, I really don't have a lot more. I do also appreciate you've renewed my confidence in Monmouth generation, by the way. I appreciate that. But I want to ask a question I think you may have answered earlier, but I'm going to ask in a different way, not so much for the record, but my brain record. With regard to the South Dakota SIP and its requirement for catalytic versus non-catalytic reduction systems, and I understand that subbituminous or Powder River is more cost-effective with SCR than lignite, but it's still a lot more expensive. My question to you would be, as an engineer with all this experience, is SCR, in your view, a necessary requirement in South Dakota?
Let me preface that by, if you look at other utilities, other plants, there are almost none that have the combustion technology of Big Stone that do not have SCRs on. So, you know, if you just take the political position that what was done for the rest of the country was the right thing to do, we're not leading the pack. We're one of the last ones to put SCRs on. Now, the distinguishing thing I have to remember, Big Stone is a cyclone-fired unit, and there are five of them in this area. You know, the three in North Dakota, Big Stone, and the Allen S. King plant in Minnesota. Allen S. King already has an SCR on, and basically everything to the east that is cyclone that isn't on lignite for one reason or another have already put SCRs on. So I would say if we're going to continue to operate it for the next 30 years, we need to put an SCR on.
I have nothing else. Thank you.
Commissioner Koch?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mark, for all your testimony. I also was kind of struck by how quickly you knew how many hours there are in a year.
I was
thinking back to my days in the engineering lab at SU, and you knew how many hours in a year and how many minutes in a week, and you just knew it just like that. So anyway, that added to your credibility, I would say. As Kevin and Tony have pointed out, a lot of ground's been covered, but I just want to bounce by a couple things. In reading through your testimony, the total cost, $489 million, but of that, $78 million for MDU ratepayers, $108 million for Otter Tail ratepayers, or about 16%. Is that accurate?
North Dakota.
North Dakota, correct. Okay, so we're talking a little bit different numbers. Just defining them a little bit better. And then I had the same question about the power loss when we added these additional potential features on. You said we lose about 9 megawatts, but in the next outage you may pick up some more?
Well, one is we're beginning the engineering work, and I think we can do better. You know,
okay.
We actually designed that, but 9 is what we have to go with now as from the conceptual design, but I think we can do better. The other side of that is we have to lower the temperature of the gases coming out of the boiler. That right. will improve the boiler efficiency, so there'll be a little bit of a trade-off, even though we're going to use more station service. We're going to burn a little less fuel to do that, so there is some trade-off.
But okay. I think you answered it, but once again, if these features are put in place, how long do you think the plant will be in compliance? Two questions. What is the life of the plant as we sit here today? How many years forward is this plant if you put the features on it? That'd be the first question. And the second, how long do you think that plant would be in compliance if we put these features on?
Let me address the first one, the life of the plant. From my experience, plants are shut down because they're not economical, not because they are worn out.
Okay.
If a utility is doing proper maintenance and proper operation, in effect, you could run the plant forever. I mean, it's like you could drive a car forever if you change the tires and, overhaul it and such. So a lot of that depends upon how you run it, how you maintain it. And then the second question, how long is it going to, is this going to be good for? Part of the application, and Mr. Grumman can address it better, but we looked at all pending EPA regulations, the train wreck issues that are in the pipeline, and really the only ones that this AQCS project doesn't address are mercury, which we've got the caveat for $5 million we can. And the other one is the potential that ash could be classified as hazardous waste. And in our financial analysis, we included a cost for that worst case, $37 a ton additional cost if it was. So we think that anything that is in the pipeline, we have included in the analysis. So it's going to have to be something that isn't on the radar screen at all.
Okay, and then I guess the last two things is just to want to commend the company for putting this together. This is a pretty good document that I've seen. A lot of this is a very complex case, and it's easy to follow. So thank you all for putting it together, because we've been to a lot of hearings where it's hard to follow through where some of the stuff is going. But then the last question, maybe not so much for you, but it would be nice if someone, and maybe you're the one, could come up and tell me why advanced determination of prudence is so important, because I've heard a lot about this is prudent. This is not a prudence case. This is advanced determination of prudence. This is my understanding, you could just go build this right now. You don't need us for anything. So if you could answer that or tell me who can best make that argument.
Well, there are probably others that can add to it, but there's really two factors. I mean, one is the length of this project. I mean, it is a long-term project that if at the end of the day we come in and it is declared not prudent, it could turn into a bet-the-company type endeavor. I mean, for Otter Tail, the larger share, $260-some million of investment. If at the end of the day we come in and the commission say this wasn't the right thing to do, the company is not large enough to absorb, $260 million of capital investment. So, do we bet the company? Well, we certainly don't want to. And the other, in this day and age with the economy and such, financing can be very competitive, and I've been told by our financial people that we will get better financing because of this, which in the end will benefit the customers because of the reduced costs.
So are you saying then that if advanced determination of prudence wouldn't be granted, that you'd have no alternative?
If it's not granted because you feel it's not prudent, then we have to go back and say, well, do you feel that a gas option is the prudent thing to do? I mean, if you punt, just say, we're not going to decide now, I don't know what the companies would do. That's a very complicated question that, the stakes are pretty high.
Okay, thank you. Will there be any? I guess I'll follow up with that later. Thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Mr. Brown, follow up?
Judge, excuse me.
Yes?
May I ask a question?
I assumed you didn't have any, but you may.
Just was prompted. I would just like to follow up on Commissioner Kalk's question. I understand what you responded. If the commission denied this application based on a decision that it was not prudent, then you would have a certain signal. But what would the company's reaction or perception be if the commission did, one, denied it not because it's not prudent, but because they don't feel that it deserved designation of advance prudence, because after all, that is all the statute's about, is advance prudence. And then the second part of the question would be, I think maybe following back around to Mr. Grumman's questioning, if the advance determination was conditioned on something. Those are a two-part question to you.
Mm-hmm. I'll start with the latter. I mean, the condition, of course, it depends upon what the conditions are. And, in the testimony, Mr. Hahn and such, there are conditions suggested, and most of them seemed reasonable. So assuming the conditions are reasonable, I don't think it's a problem. The first one, I can't speak for any of the three companies on what their position would be if the advance determination of prudence is denied. I can't.
Is there another witness that can answer that? Because it's a central component of this case. You've answered the part about if mm-hmm. it's not, if it prudence is denied, but the statute is really about advance decisions, advance prudence determinations. I mean, a simple question is, would the companies proceed or not?
And I don't know.
Is there another witness that we can ask?
Mr.
Maybe Mr. Brown can answer that question in due course.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have.
Follow up, Mr. Brown.
Your Honor, I just have one question. It pertains to the baghouse, which came up a number of times. And, Mr. Rolfes, could I refer you to the document that's been marked as Exhibit 111? You had identified that earlier as the South Dakota Regional Hay SIP. Yeah. And if I could take you to page 99 of that document.
I'm there now.
So can you confirm for the record that what we're looking at is the South Dakota State Implementation Plan?
Yes, it is.
And Section 6 of this State Implementation Plan, that starts at page 72, covers the best available retrofit technology. Is that right?
That's right.
And is that the part of the SIP that contains the requirements that make up the AQCS?
Yes.
And if I could refer you then to page 99 and specifically to section 6.3.5.1, it's titled Particulate Matter BART Recommendation. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
Could, just for the record, could you read the first paragraph there? There consists of three sentences.
Otter Tail Power Company already installed and is operating a bag house, which is the top particulate control technology. Therefore, there is no additional compliance cost, energy impacts, et cetera, that Otter Tail Power Company would have to endure. As such, DENR considers the continual use of the baghouse as BART for particulate matter.
Mr. Rolfes, you gave testimony earlier about the Minnesota Department of Commerce and its position on the eligibility of the baghouse under the Minnesota ADP statute. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in terms of the position, as you understand it, taken by the Minnesota Department of Commerce, does it relate to the requirement as set forth in this paragraph on page 99?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman, follow up?
No, Your Honor.
Jeff Goatsack will follow up.
No, thank you.
Follow up from the commission. Commissioner Kalk.
Just, I guess, one question. I wanted to clarify in my mind something you said before about the life cycle of a plant. It gets to where it's no longer cost effective. Is that based on a price per kilowatt? I mean, how do you run those numbers? What's the model? I mean, when it becomes 30 cents per kilowatt, you switch to something else, or that number would always be moving, I would assume.
Well, you're absolutely right. It's based on the market. I mean, it's easier to relate looking back. next, close to Big Stone, within about 5 miles, Otter Tail used to have a plant at Ordinville, Minnesota. It was built in 1950. It stopped operating in 1982, only 32 years, and it was torn down 10 years later. And the plant was probably in physically its best condition of its life when we tore it down. But because of its size, it couldn't compete with the larger plants like Big Stone. And, you know, and that's the thing that put a lot of smaller plants, you know, to bed, was they couldn't compete with the economy of scale. Today we're seeing things, a different economic factor, the need to put all of this equipment on smaller plants. Again, the economy of scale is playing into the plants that are in the 25, 50 megawatt. The Ordinville plant was 15 megawatts, but now the plants that are still running that are 25, 50 megawatts of size to put all this stuff on that we're talking about drives its cost up, so it, you know, may not be competitive anymore. So it's what's going to happen in the marketplace, what drives costs up for a unit, not because they physically won't run, but because there's some requirement that raises the cost that they're no longer in the market, in the money.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the commission? Once more, Mr. Brown?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Grobin?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, Your Honor. Thank,
thank you very much, Mr. Rolfes.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown, your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. Our next witness is Terry Grobin.
Mr. Grobin, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years, or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Mr. Grobin, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Mr. Brown.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you state your full name for the record?
Terry Grobin.
And who is your employer?
I'm employed by Otter Tail Power Company.
And what is your current position?
I'm the manager of environmental services.
And can you describe your responsibilities in that position, please?
My responsibilities include the permitting in the areas of air quality, solid waste, and water quality, including several other areas in the environmental area, including the permitting for the Big Stone plant.
And you're testifying this morning on behalf of both companies, since Otter Tail serves as the operating agent for the Big Stone plant, is that correct?
That's correct.
What has been your role in the Big Stone AQCS project?
I've been primarily following on the environmental type of issues associated with the development of the determination of compliance for Big Stone with respect to, first of all, the modeling, and then would complete the project ultimately with the permitting of the construction for the construction of the project itself.
And are you familiar with the South Dakota SIP regulatory process as it pertains to the AQCS project?
I am.
And did Otter Tail, as the operating agent for the Big Stone plant, participate in the South Dakota SIP regulatory process?
We did.
Can you explain what its involvement was?
Well, first of all, Big Stone is a BART eligible source. It was operated at the time, began operating at the time that's regulated by the regional haze rules. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Big Stone is regulated by the BART process or the visibility rule compliance process, the regional haze process. The key to whether or not Big Stone is regulated by the BART process is whether or not it's subject to the BART requirements, and that's determined whether or not the emissions from the Big Stone plant contributed to visibility impairment in some of the Class 1 areas. And what Otter Tail did, as well as our air quality modeling expert and Hunt and Williams, our outside counsel, we worked for a period of more than 2 years to develop a modeling protocol that was acceptable by to EPA and also the federal land managers for assessing whether or not BART or Big Stone plant emissions had regional haze impacts, and that's then the hinge or the linchpin as to whether or not ultimately the plant needed to comply with the BART requirements or the requirement to install best available retrofit technology. In September of 2009, the approved modeling found that indeed Big Stone did contribute to visibility impairment in the Class 1 areas. And as a result of that finding, Otter Tail and its consultant, Burns and McDonald, proceeded with a best available retrofit technology, or a BART study, that we were obligated to complete under the protocol adopted by EPA in 2005, and that was protocol that was put into place during the Bush administration.
Mr. Grauman, have you supplied rebuttal testimony in this case?
I have.
And I just might note for the record that has been marked as Exhibit 110 in the case. And in your rebuttal testimony, did you respond to some of the points that have been made by Mr. Hahn in his testimony for advocacy staff?
I did.
And one of the points that you responded to, as I recall, pertained to Mr. Hahn's claim that the owners of the Big Stone plant are not currently required to install the AQCS project. Is that right?
That is correct.
And what was your testimony on that point? Do you agree with Mr. Hahn on that point?
I do not agree with Mr. Hahn on that point.
Could you please explain?
Well, the co-owners of Big Stone plant are currently required to install the AQCS pursuant to the South Dakota Regional Haze Rule. It's Administrative Rules of South Dakota, Chapter 743621, and particularly paragraph 07 of that particular rule.
And when was the South Dakota Regional Haze Rule adopted?
The South Dakota Regional Haze Rule was adopted by the South Dakota Board of Minerals and Environment on September 15th of 2010.
What were the major requirements in that rule?
Well, the requirements of the rule essentially included prescriptive requirements that establish emission limits for SO2, NOx, and particulate matter for electric generating plants. Now, just to be clear, the rule itself doesn't specifically identify Big Stone plant, but on the other hand, Big Stone plant is really the only BART-eligible electric utility generating unit in the state of South Dakota.
And does the rule establish a compliance schedule?
It does.
What is that?
What the rule requires is that the upgrades must be made as expeditiously as practicable, but no later than 5 years after approval of the South Dakota Regional, or the EPA approval of the South Dakota Regional Haze SIP.
This might be a good time to go to the exhibit list again, and I believe there are three exhibits in addition to your rebuttal testimony that you're the sponsor of. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the first one is OTP MDU 111 that was referred to earlier as the South Dakota State Implementation Plan. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Can you briefly describe what that document is?
Briefly, what that document is, it's Chapter 7, and it's a portion of the overall South Dakota Regional Haze SIP that establishes and it goes through the South Dakota rationale for its decision-making process with respect to the air quality control system at Big Stone.
And did you mean to say Chapter 7?
It should be Chapter 6.
Okay, I believe you said Chapter 7.
Excuse me.
Okay, and Chapter 6 covers the BART requirements, is that
correct?
Covers
the BART requirements for Big Stone.
And then the second document marked at 112, it had been identified earlier as the assessment of anticipated federal and state environmental regulations. Can you describe that document, please?
As Mr. Rolfes mentioned previously, that is the assessment of what we believe to be the rules that are on the horizon that would be adopted by either EPA or could be adopted by either EPA or some of the states with respect to their ongoing rulemaking processes, and we try to relate the implementation of those rules to what additional requirements might be imposed at Big Stone.
And just one more document. It's Exhibit 113, the South Dakota Regional Haze Administrative Rules. Can you briefly describe that document?
That rule is essentially a rule that EPA or South Dakota needed to develop as part of its regional haze rulemaking process that established the requirements that would apply to facilities with respect to the BART process and compliance with the requirements.
And how does South Dakota implement the regional haze rule?
Well, the implementation of the regional haze rule is essentially the development of the rule and the development of the SIP, and both of those then are submitted to EPA ultimately for their review and hopefully their approval.
And so South Dakota obviously has prepared a state implementation plan, is that correct?
That is correct.
And that's what is, again, Exhibit 111. Has South Dakota submitted the SIP to EPA for approval?
Yes, they have.
And when did they do that?
They did the initial submittal in January of 2010.
And 2010?
2011.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you. And has the proposed SIP been revised at any time?
Yes, it has been.
And when was that?
It was revised in September of 2011 in response to some comments, non-technical type of comments that EPA had made with respect to testing and monitoring, record-keeping, and reporting requirements for shutdown and malfunction periods.
And did those revisions pertain in any way to the selection of technologies that constitute BART for the Big Stone plant?
No, they did not.
And is Exhibit 113, the South Dakota Regional Haze Administrative Rules, does that reflect the revisions that were made more recently?
I believe it does, yes.
Do you have any expectation at this time as to when EPA will complete its review of the South Dakota SIP?
Based on an email exchange that I had in response to a question that I posed to them in August of this year, we're expecting that essentially EPA would propose a draft approval of the regional haze SIP today. It should appear subsequently in the Federal Register. That schedule was confirmed yesterday afternoon in conversation, actually in a voicemail message in response to a message that I had left with EPA asking about the schedule and whether or not they're on schedule. They aren't on schedule. They are expecting that today. And they're expecting to proceed then with the final approval and final administrative signature on in March 29th of next year, of 2012.
Could I refer you for a moment to Exhibit 110, please? I think there should be a copy of it in that first Redwell. And I believe this is the document that you've identified earlier as your rebuttal testimony. Is that right?
That is correct.
And there is an attachment at the end of your testimony. Could you turn to that for a moment, please?
I have it.
It's the last page of the document, and it appears to be an email. Is that correct?
It is.
Can you explain what this email represents?
Well, it's actually a series of two emails. One, it's an email from myself to Monica Morales of Region 8 EPA asking for an update on EPA schedule for the South Dakota Regional Haze State Implementation Plan approval. And then the second email, which would be the email that would be located on the top, is her response.
And these are the emails that in large part were the basis for the testimony that you just gave about your expectations about how EPA intends to proceed on its review of the SIP?
They are, yes.
I offer this witness for cross-examination, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman.
Thank you, Your Honor. What powers do you have to fight the state implementation plan? What's available in that regard?
Otter Tail participated in the rulemaking process. We were a part of the process. What South Dakota had done is they had taken the proposed BART analysis and they had essentially adopted everything that we had proposed with respect to SO2 and particulate control technology. They did not agree with our recommendation that SNCR and a combination of that with separated over fire air be BART for NOx control. We became aware of that in their draft BART determination that we first saw in January of 2010. And at that particular time, we took a look at their rationale and then also considered other regulatory activities that EPA is proceeding on with respect to ambient air quality standards and other types of activities, including EPA's new source review EPA enforcement initiative. And we looked at that and we said that and evaluated that in the context of whether or not we felt we would be successful, and at the end we supported the DENR's determination.
In your opinion, do you feel that regional haze will be materially altered within the next few years?
Could you clarify that question for me? Do you mean in terms of the reduction of regional haze at the Class 1 unit, in the Class 1 units, or do you mean changes in the regional haze regulations?
Changes in the regional haze regulations, i.e. that hypothetically, if there were a market change in the law, thereby making this AQCS, very expensive AQCS project, unnecessary, and therefore along those lines, that's what I'm looking for.
We have to, or at least I go back and take a look at the source of the requirements for the regional haze, and those are embedded in the Clean Air Act. Subsequent to the adoption of the Clean Air Act by Congress, EPA proceeded with rulemakings that established the framework that the regional haze evaluation needs to occur and how those control technologies are deemed to be BART for purposes of compliance. Those are all embedded in the rules as they are embedded in the Clean Air Act. Beyond that, EPA has entered into or lodged a consent decree with the D.C. Circuit Court that essentially establishes a schedule for adopting or approving the regional haze SIPs for the states, and South Dakota is included in that. So that given the long history of the underlying regulatory requirements, I don't expect any changes at all to the regional haze rules.
Notwithstanding, if there's a significant political shift at the next election, is that something that could affect your analysis? And if so, please explain.
There would have to be a significant enough shift for Congress to make a significant change to the Clean Air Act in order for that to happen.
Hypothetically, of course, we're talking about the Big Stone plant. You were here, of course, from Mr. Rolfe's testimony where he indicated that the fuel source for Big Stone had changed back in 1995 from lignite to Powder River Basin coal. Now, let's hypothetically, let's say that that changeover never occurred. What would be BART under these under those circumstances?
I really can't answer that question because South Dakota would have to go through their BART analysis, much like they did for Big Stone under its current fuel, and whether or not they would reach a similar conclusion or a different conclusion, I guess I can't really say right now. And ultimately, whatever they adopt would have to be approved by EPA.
Well, clearly you're aware of what's going on in North Dakota with their essentially the fight between the Department of Health and the EPA in regards to the effectiveness of SCR technology on lignite coal. In your opinion, in your knowledge of the South Dakota DENR, would they take a similar approach under the same circumstances as the Department of Health is now with our lignite coal plants here in North Dakota?
I can't be certain of that one way or the other.
I'd like to expand upon a little bit of the powers available to essentially challenge the South Dakota DENR. I mean, were there any lobbying efforts or anything in that regard expended to try to mitigate the financial ramifications of this to the ratepayers or the shareholders for that matter?
With respect to their decision, there wasn't any specific lobbying. Obviously, we were disappointed by their decision, but between the time that we filed our BART analysis, which was our study, and their decision-making, we didn't have any communication with those folks with respect to their technology selection other than a discussion with them to make sure that they were on track with the decision in terms of the schedule. But from what I know of the DENR, when we saw their BART analysis, it was very complete and well done. And on that basis, and knowing those folks as I know them, we decided not to pursue any challenge to their decision.
Along those lines, were there any resources expended to try to sway public sentiment, like ads, no to EPA or something in that regard?
No, there were not.
As indicated before in prior testimony, the rates for North Dakota ratepayers for Otter Tail Power and MDU are going to increase both by 16%. How does that affect your competitiveness in the marketplace?
I guess I wouldn't be the one to speak to that question.
Who would?
Perhaps our resource planner?
Mr. Draxton.
Mr. Draxton.
Have there been any cost-saving measures implemented in the Big Stone plant to help mitigate the negative ramifications of this AQCS project as far as financial ramifications?
I don't quite understand your question.
Well, as I indicated before, I mean, if the AQCS project is implemented, the rates will be going up for 16% for ratepayers for both OTP and MDU. To help lower that impact, have there been any other type of cost savings that have been implemented in the Big Stone plant to help mitigate, cushion that ultimate effect?
None that I can specifically think of or that I'm aware of. Obviously, we always look for opportunities to improve plant efficiencies and to improve our generation. But beyond that, I'm not aware of anything specific.
Now, before, obviously, in the state implementation plan, there's discussing about, I believe, is it class one areas? Could you please explain how the modeling works to determine which areas are class one areas?
Well, the modeling doesn't determine the class one areas. The class one areas were essentially set by congressional action as a part of the Clean Air Act. There were 156, I believe, Class 1 areas that were established across the United States that Congress, at the time the Clean Air Act was adopted, felt they deserved extra protection. Not all of those Class 1 areas are regulated for visibility purposes, and I can think of one in Wisconsin, the Lost Woods area. But then there are many others, including several of those in Rainbow Lakes, in Wisconsin. Lost Woods is in North Dakota.
Well, really what I'm looking for is a nexus between the Big Stone plant and the Class 1 areas in particular. How has that modeling occurred, i.e. that I believe the three Class 1 areas are Boundary Waters, Isle Royale in Michigan, and Voyageurs. Please explain. I mean, essentially a model determined that there was either a cause or a contribution by the Big Stone plant to those areas. If you could please explain that process.
Well, first of all, I'm not intimately familiar with the ins and outs of the modeling process, but from a high-level perspective, the modeling is designed to determine the visibility impacts of the emissions from specific to Big Stone plant. It doesn't look at any other facilities, but it just looks at the contribution from Big Stone plant. And if the emissions from Big Stone plant contribute to a visibility impairment at any of the Class 1 areas above 0.5 decibels for 98% of the time, then the regulatory agencies are of the opinion, or they've made the decision, that those sources then are subject to BART requirements.
Well, it's my understanding through this process is that there were Class 1 areas that are originally determined by South Dakota. There was a negotiation between Otter Tail Power and the South Dakota DENR in that regard, which ultimately resulted in a reclassification of which the Class 1 areas were. So that's my understanding of the modeling involved. Clearly, there had to be some type of substantiation offered in that regard for them to change their mind. And that's what I'm looking for, that technical analysis.
Okay. South Dakota initially was planning on embarking on modeling that would have been done under their direction through the Western Regional Air Partnership, RAP. And that modeling was done, and that modeling showed some impacts on some Class 1 areas. And I don't remember which Class 1 areas they showed impacts. We didn't realize, or we did know that that modeling was going on behind the scenes, but we hadn't seen any of those results until about August of 2007. We took a look at that data, and we asked for the detailed model inputs and information, and we found out that there were a number of errors with respect to plant emissions and stack parameters and other factors that led us to believe that even though it showed visibility impacts, it was inaccurate. So at that particular time, we went back to the South Dakota DENR and asked to do a modeling of our own, and they agreed to allow us to do that.
Very good. Now, regional haze, of course, is aesthetic. That's correct? And, I mean, it's not something that's a pollutant. I have a couple of questions about, I guess, the dynamics with regional haze determination. Can coal plant-induced haze be observed when the wind is blowing strongly, for instance?
I can't really answer that question. I'm not in a position to answer that question.
Okay. Who would within your company or MDU?
I don't believe anyone could. I think it's a matter of opinion.
So essentially, I mean, there's a determination made as far as the cause and contribution of regional haze, but there's been no analysis and no one's available within your companies to make that determination of what specifically is affected in that regard. I mean, is that what I'm understanding? Or
we haven't done any specific analysis. What we've been going by in order to determine whether or not there's a legitimate regulatory reason for us to install ambient air quality control equipment, we've been relying on the regulations, in which we have no choice but to do. And those regulations that establish some of the parameters as a part of this process were those that were adopted in 2005 as a part of 40 CFR Part 51.
Now, I mean, you can understand from a ratepayer standpoint our anxiety in that we're spending potentially $489 million, plus or minus 20%, and from what I'm understanding is that there's been no discussion towards the scientific fundamentals of whether regional haze, of even the dynamics about how it works and those type of characteristics.
Objection. I think that mischaracterizes the witness's testimony.
Well, your witness is doing very well, Mr. Brown. Overruled.
Just one moment, Your Honor. So really, I mean, essentially, if I had any questions about the dynamics of regional haze and how it's affected by wind speed and et cetera, are you qualified to answer any of those questions?
I am not.
Okay. And I guess just to reiterate, and no one available here or no one that you're aware of can answer those questions?
No one that I'm aware of, either within Otter Tail or MDU.
I just have one further question then. I guess out of curiosity, of course, the implementation of the state implementation plan, once it's accepted by the EPA, there's this language expeditiously as practical or within 5 years. This expeditiously as practical, is it essentially toothless? I mean, you're never going to get fined as long as it's implemented in 5 years. Could you please explain that further?
I guess I would need to have a little bit more explanation of your question.
Well, I mean, it's the federal rule or wherever it comes out, it says expeditiously as practical, or it talks about implementation within 5 years. So clearly they added expeditiously as practical within that language. However, it's my understanding that if a company were to comply within that five-year period, that would be acceptable and there would be no fines or et cetera. I'm just wondering why expeditiously as practical is included in that language as far as implementation?
I am not certain of the rationale for the DENRs adding that to their statute.
More specifically, are you aware of any circumstances whereby a company has complied within the five-year period, but they were otherwise fined because they weren't expeditiously as practical? That's essentially what I'm getting at.
I'm not aware of any, but that doesn't mean they don't exist.
Okay. Just one moment, Your Honor. Anything else? No further questions, Your Honor.
Is Jeff Kotsacko?
We have no questions at this time. Thank
questions
you.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Could you explain for me the consent decree process that you talked about with regard to the, I think it had to do with the EPA rules with regard to regional haze. What is that process? Who is EPA entering a consent with? I assume it's with the blessing of a court, but are they negotiating with themselves or other parties?
No, they're negotiating with other parties, including Wild Earth Guardians and Sierra Club, and we're not a party to it.
So how does that work? You're the impacted entity, but outside groups that have, sued the EPA go behind closed doors and they strike a deal and it's blessed by the court. And at what point do ratepayers, utilities have an ability to impact that, or do you not? I'm just trying to figure out how these consent decrees work from a legal standpoint, or to the degree,
First of all, I'm not an attorney.
Always a safe answer.
So you'll have to go with my understanding of it.
Sure.
But based on my understanding of it, there's a consent decree that is agreed to among a group of entities, and the entities aren't necessarily parties to anything because they aren't there's no ongoing rule that they're trying to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
But the consent decree, I believe its purpose is to force the EPA to take action within a specific time frame on certain outstanding issues that they've failed to act on. And that consent decree is lodged with a court. It's not final and will not be final until there's an opportunity for public comment in a public notice period, that once it's published in the Federal Register.
Mm. Okay. I'd like to understand the modeling issue a little bit better. From what I understand from your testimony, it's the modeling that triggers whether Big Stone 2 qualifies as a unit that is maybe required to have this BART technology. Is that correct? So are you familiar with the dispute between North Dakota and the EPA on modeling as with regards to actual observed results as opposed to computer modeling?
I am somewhat familiar with that.
Okay. Was this a point of dispute in South Dakota with the South Dakota SIP, or is the modeling that was accepted by the South Dakota Regulatory Authority simply the computer models that may or may not actually reflect reality of what's going on the ground?
If I may, I'd like to just explain the differences between those two
Sure.
modelings. The modeling that is currently under some dispute in North Dakota is the modeling to determine what the ambient air quality standards are and how those model values might relate to measured values at the monitoring sites that are around the state. Now, for purposes of the visibility modeling, the visibility impact modeling for Big Stone and all the other plants, that can only be determined by modeling because you're looking at a specific source's contribution to visibility impairment at an individual Class 1 area. And so there's no way to test that model unless you can physically turn off all of the other sources for an extended period of time to see whether or not that source does indeed have that impact.
Okay. Well, that might help answer my next question, which is, if Big Stone 2 was shut down completely, would the human eye be able to detect any difference at all in any of the Class 1 areas? And let's say it's taken offline altogether. And
the way that I could answer that is based on the modeling results, there would be a perceptible difference.
based on the modeling results. There would, okay. But is that in combination with all the other sources of emissions that might exist, or in and of itself?
That would be the Big Stone's contribution to whatever else might be impacting, what other sources might be impacting.
Is that based on a certain number of hours per year that they assume would there would be an impact, or is that every day year-round? Or
it's not necessarily every day year-round simply because of the changes in wind direction, meteorology, and things of that nature, but it impacts the Big Stone emissions would impact the visibility in these areas beyond the requirements that would trigger BART. In other words, there's a specific time frame that Big Stone's contribution would contribute to visibility impairment, and Big Stone's emissions would trigger the BART process based on its level of contribution.
Would there be a visible difference to the human eye if SNCR was used as opposed to SCR? In other words, if I was sitting there in Ely looking out over the boundary waters, could I say, wow, I'm glad they installed that SCR as opposed to the SNCR? I can tell the difference.
I can't answer that question.
Okay. With regard to the SO2 and NOx portions of regional haze, to the degree that either of those two pollutants would cause a health problem, would those be covered by other EPA rules? Is that?
They would be. Okay. Typically, SO2 and NOx are considered precursors to PM2.5.
Okay.
And EPA is setting ambient air quality standards for PM2.5, so that to the extent that we're making emissions reductions at Big Stone, it could impact our continued compliance. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean, or doesn't mean that we're out of compliance right now, but it just lowers those emissions.
When you say PM2.5, could you describe to me what that is?
Particulate matter of 2.5 microns or less.
And that is something different than what we're dealing with in the context of regional haze?
Yes.
Okay. That may cause a health effect, as opposed to just a visibility impact.
Only if the ambient air quality levels are above the standards set to be protective of human health by EPA.
Okay, that's all I have. Thanks.
Further questions from the commission? Commissioner Koch.
Sure. Thank you for your testimony. Just a couple things. You talked about the studies involved leading up to the SIP. Are those anywhere in any of these exhibits, the actual studies that led to this is a study that then caused the state of South Dakota to do things and you guys eventually agreed to it? Where are those studies at?
They aren't a part of this docket.
Are they? Is it volumes and volumes? Is it something that could easily be given as a late exhibit that we could look through?
They would be available as a late exhibit.
I think I'd like to ask for that, Your Honor. Providing, if it's 40 volumes, I don't want 40 volumes. There's like an executive summary or something that we could. It'd be nice to have that as part of the record.
Which, Mr. Grauman. Give me a description of what you would propose to provide pursuant to Commissioner Koch's request.
What I would propose to provide is I don't have the specific titles of it, but
general description.
Yeah, the general description would be the findings of the ambient air quality or the visibility impact modeling for the regional haze, and then also the BART analysis, or the BART study, those two studies.
And those would include the methodologies and all those, I would presume?
There should be general descriptions for that information.
Okay, that's visibility impact modeling for regional haze. And
the BART analysis study?
Mr. Brown, this fits in under your category 400, does it, or where?
In the 100 series, Your Honor.
Okay.
It would be a joint exhibit, Your Honor, if we offered this. So we've offered exhibits, I think, through 115A, so this would be exhibit 116.
So it would be OTP/MDU 115C?
No, it could be 116 would be the next exhibit. And then if we have multiple documents, Your Honor, do you want them all under that one number?
Yes, please.
Okay, so we'll do A, B, and C and so forth.
For the record. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Brown, objection?
No objection, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, Your Honor.
So for the record, visibility impact modeling for regional haze and the BART BART analysis study will be OTP/MDU exhibit, will be exhibit OTP/MDU 116. Anything further, Commissioner?
Just, I guess, you testified one of the questions about there wasn't a, quote, lobbying effort put forward particularly to stop this from being implemented. And previous witness testified that this could theoretically cause the whole company to have to be leveraged. Just curious if you could expand on that thought process, that knowing something could coming down the pike could theoretically have you leverage the whole company to come in compliance. Why wasn't there more effort put into adjusting the standards to meet what they needed to be to keep the company viable?
What we would have to do under that scenario, we would have to go back to EPA to get them to change their standards for a rule that had already been adopted, essentially, and by the time this process was being initiated and worked on 5 years prior to where our particular work. And other utilities were also having to comply with the same rule, so it would be difficult for us as a lone utility to convince EPA, at least in our opinion, to change their rule based on our lone circumstances.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Kramer.
Just one, I think just to help clarify some things for me. Could you give a brief overview of the comparison between the Utility MACT rule and the cross-state air pollution rule, its timelines, and any synergies in compliance with the two that might be gained?
Well, first of all, with respect to this particular proceeding, Big Stone isn't subject to the cross-state air pollution control rule. South Dakota is not included in those states that are part of that rulemaking process. The possible synergies, there are some possible synergies to the extent that utilities that choose to comply with the cross-state air pollution control rule would add emission control technologies to reduce their emissions. They might better enable them to meet some of the requirements under the MACT rules, under the maximum achievable control technology for hazardous air pollutants. For example, for those utilities that happen to burn high sulfur coal, if they have to add a scrubber, by adding a scrubber could help reduce emissions of acid gases that might be regulated under the MACT process. Where the CASPER rule differs from what we believe the MACT rule is the CASPER rule doesn't necessarily require individual unit-by-unit compliance. You're able to go out, at least theoretically and by allowances, to cover any emissions in excess of those that you have been granted allowances for, much like the acid rain provisions, for example, under the Clean Air Act. The MACT requirements, to the largest degree, are a unit-by-unit compliance requirement. There isn't any opportunities for emission averaging unless you might have some limited opportunities between facilities at the same site or between units at the same site. Does that help?
That's perfect. Yeah, okay. Thank you very much. I'm nothing.
Further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Grauman, could I take you back to Otter Tail MDU Exhibit 111, please, which is the state implementation plan?
Okay.
And in the early part of that document, it's on the fourth page, there's a list of tables that appear to be part of this state implementation plan. So Roman 4 at the bottom in the page designation.
Okay.
I think you testified earlier that the relevant part of the state implementation plan for this proceeding is in Chapter 6, is that right?
That is correct.
And I believe as this list of tables is set up, the tables that correspond to Chapter 6 are those that are listed table 6-, and then there's a series of those that run 1 through 16. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Could you take a moment, please, and see if, in your opinion, any of those particular tables would be responsive to any of the questions that you've received from the commissioners regarding the state implementation plan?
Two possible tables might be table 6-12 and 6-14 that describe Big Stone's contribution to visibility emissions impairment. Where it looks at each of the control options as compared to the existing plant.
Could we first go to table 612, and I believe that's on page 93, is that correct?
That's correct.
Could you take a moment and review that and see if you want to supplement your earlier testimony in any way?
Well, I might, with respect to table 612, what this does is, from a modeling perspective, it illustrates Big Stone's emissions contribution to visibility impairment in each of the identified Class 1 areas in deciviews.
Anything else with respect to Table 6-12?
Only to the extent that EPA, again a part of their rules, classifies a deciview, identifies that a 0.5 deciview change is on the edge of visible perception. But again, that's based on EPA's definition, if you will, with respect to its rule. Whether or not each individual person could detect a visibility change, I can't say.
But then we then turn to table 6-14. I believe that's on page 95. Is that correct?
Correct.
And what does this table represent?
This table represents the deciview visibility impairment contribution for each of the combinations of control technologies that we had included as a part of our BART process.
Is there anything that you take away from Table 6-14 that you would offer to supplement your earlier testimony?
Well, only to the extent that under option 8, we note that all of the DESAVIEW visibility impairments are all less than that 0.5 EPA threshold. I might add to that, and I should probably add to that for purposes of clarity, that is also true for options 6, 7, and 8. Those options also met the DESAVIEW improvement criteria, but for purposes of the BART evaluation, South Dakota's DNR cost effectiveness test was, for purposes of their evaluation, was $900 per ton, and all of those were less than $900 per ton, and consequently they needed to be considered as a part of the BART process and as technologies, and they selected the last technology because it offered the most improvement, which is the technology that is being considered as a part of the AQCS process.
Your Honor, can I have just one moment, please?
You may.
Mr. Grauman, you were asked some questions earlier regarding the case involving the North Dakota Department of Health and the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. Do you recall that testimony?
I do.
And is the issue at stake in that proceeding under a different federal regulatory program than the regional haze requirements in issue in this case?
It is.
Okay. Thank you. I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Grauman.
Just one, Your Honor. Before we had discussed the North Dakota Department of Health and their ongoing litigation with the EPA in regards to BART technology for lignite coal. Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that, of course, the fight concerns whether SCR technology is applicable for lignite. I'm just curious as to your opinion. Do you believe that the North Dakota Department of Health is correct in their assertions? Could you please expand upon that?
In my opinion, the technology hasn't been demonstrated on lignite-fired units, and that would be the reason that it wouldn't be a viable consideration in the process.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I have nothing, thank you.
Follow-up by the commission. Commissioner Clark.
Sure. Thanks. If you could help me understand this Table 6-14, the modeling results that you were talking about. And you had said that 6, 7, and 8 were all beneath the threshold. Is that right? That would be acceptable?
That is correct.
And so is 6 is the SNCR technology. Number 8 was what was ultimately chosen. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Explain to me the values that are in parentheses and what that means.
The values that are in parentheses are the numerical rounding of the values that we had presented in each of those columns. What we did not round our values. We reported them consistent with the methodology and the rounding protocol that RAP had originally used as a part of their study for the South Dakota DNR. And the DNR's position was is that since the standard of visibility improvement was 0.5 deciviews, they felt it appropriate to carry only the number of significant digits that's representative of the standard.
Okay. And then if you could go over with me again the decision for the state of South Dakota to select the SCR in its SIP and not SNCR if they both met the standard, and if one is significantly cheaper, why wouldn't you go with the cheaper option that meets the standard as opposed to the more expensive one?
It's my understanding that as a part of the BART rule that's embodied in the 2005 EPA requirements that have been published, you need to look at not only the achievement of the standard, but what technology represents best available retrofit technology. And simply meeting the standard does not necessarily, at least in EPA's mind, establish that best technology.
Okay.
What they did do is they took a look at the costs and established a cost evaluation. And for the level of improvement that at least the modeling showed, the additional costs for the SCR were warranted.
But as I also understand it, relating to the level at which the improvement is perceptible, am I also reading it correctly, the table correctly, to understand that the difference between SCR and SNCR is not a visibly perceptible difference?
I would have to...
And you may get, in modeling, you may get somewhat better results by SCR, so that qualifies as the BART technology. But as I understand it, we're meeting a visibility standard for which the difference between the two might not be visible. Am I understanding it correctly?
In some cases, that could be the case, correct.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Brown?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Mr. Grumman?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Did Jeff Gotsacko?
Nothing further.
Thank you very much, Mr. Grumman. We should, I think, Mr. Brown, I'd prefer not to start your next witness. I would rather recess early for lunch. I would take just an hour for lunch, however, no more. So let's resume at 12:45.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I swear I feel...
Well, and you know what's...